new people. But we are the same team, the Portfolio Committee on Health. We are not going to, I won't waste any time. I will hand over to you. Minister, I would assume that you are leading your delegation. How then the presentation will be done, it will entirely depend on you. Just a reminder that our phones are to go silent. Questions are asked by members. If somebody wants to ask any question outside the members of the portfolio committee, we do so during break. Pictures are not taken. They're only taken by those that are designated to do that. Thank you very much. Over to you, Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and honorable members of the committee. Chairperson, let me start the meeting in a bad way, because when you start the meeting by apologizing, it's already a very bad example. But unfortunately, there's a big mining summit taking place in Johannesburg tomorrow. I'm one of the first speakers, so I'm going to take a 7 o'clock flight. I'm just looking at the time and the amount of work. And I'm asking up front that if by 6 o'clock we haven't finished, I'll have to rush to the plane. Yes. Secondly, Chairperson, I don't think I should waste time. I'll help to respond to questions. Rather than giving statements up front, I'll just allow the DG to go on and make the presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, DG. Over.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, Minister, Deputy Minister and colleagues. We're presenting the annual report. Chair, I will highlight areas of performance and those areas that are of concern and indicate what are the remedial actions that we've taken. So I will not spend time on achievements and highlights, but mainly those areas that are of concern. So this is our vision and mission, and I will not repeat those, but also that our plan is mainly based on the National Development Plan. In some of the areas, we don't necessarily report in our annual performance plan, but the performance is presented through various surveys that are conducted or reports by our statutory bodies or other research institutions like MRC or the Health Systems Trust or other similar agencies. And under the medium-term strategic framework, next year will be the last year of our MTSF. So meaning there's going to be a new cycle. We will also have a report that will produce in the form of a book like we did with the first edition. The 2014 will do a similar exercise. So under program one, Chair, you'll realize that the vacancy rate was 12.5%, which exceeded the DPSA target of 10%. Now, the Treasury put a cap on COE, and if you look at our overall expenditure on COE, it's actually at 98%. We had vacancies that we consciously decided we're not going to fill because we're reorganizing the way the department functions in preparation for implementation of NHI. We had two DDG posts, and if you look at the budget for two DDG posts and as well as other senior posts, they are quite significant. And we decided we'll not fill those, rather fit within the the Treasury COE, because normally when we have a labor negotiations chair and the agreements are signed, we are told to absorb that within our budget. If there are performance appraisals and we have to pay personnel, we have to do that within our allocated budget. So we have sort of tried to fit within the budget and ensure that we didn't exceed that. But we, as part of that reprioritization process, we were of the view that we'll achieve a significant saving, and this will also help us reprogram. For instance, we put disease programs together. Dr. Jürgen Pillay was responsible for maternal child health and HIV/AIDS, TB. But we said, you know, when you present in a facility, you don't present with communicable diseases only. Sometimes it's both. So it's better programmatically if you put disease areas together. Also, when you look at the systems, the health system is a continuum. You present in a clinic, you get referred, you use emergency medical services, you end up in a hospital. So we pulled all of those together so that you can look at that as a system. So we've reorganized in that context, but also in the preparation for NHS. So the turnaround recruitment process was within 4 months, which was far above the target of 6 months set by DPSA. We've achieved unqualified audit opinion, but we do have issues that the Auditor General raised, honorable members, which would like to express as a concern on our part for the following reasons. In that, we've looked at the standard, it's accounting language, accounting standards that are applied, and based on those accounting standards, honorable members, we asked the AG specific questions about a balance between compliance and service delivery. And we have written both the Accountant General and the Auditor General, and we'll share the correspondence with yourself about the issues that we raised, but we'll deal with those later when we come to deal with the particularly irregular expenditure. So Chair, these are the areas that I said I will not specifically go into, except the vacancy rate and also the provinces. The provinces, we had thought that this year we'll have 5 of them demonstrating improvement in audit outcomes. In fact, we thought it would even be 6. The 2 that did not, meaning we maintained the status, except that Northwest, we're hopeful that Northwest would regain their original status because they have been unqualified for a long period, except for the past 2 audit cycles. And also Mpumalanga was very close, and the finding was something that I think they can deal with. So unfortunately, we're still with 4 provinces. Chair, for the next one, in terms of performance, we've met our targets. In some areas, we've sort of exceeded, and this is with regard to a business continuity plan, as well as the integrated communication system. You'll see, I know that, honorable members, when you see on the board, you see pillar, but you see pillar here, but you see pillar everywhere else, and also associated with our campaign for health, and Mr. Popomaja behind us is leading that campaign of getting the country to be aware and some of the initiatives that we communicate health messaging. Under Program 1, I want to highlight that our performance agreement, all SMS members must sign. We only had 1 person who signed, but he signed after the deadline. So we still say we achieved 100% because everybody signed, but DPSA is very particular about the stipulated deadline, so this particular individual only signed after the deadline had passed. So we have written a letter to take the disciplinary action about this. In fact, the decision is that if you sign your performance agreement outside the set deadline, it means you don't qualify for assessment. Even if you perform or you qualify for a bonus, you will not get it if you miss the deadline. So this is in line with the DPSA prescription. Under Program 2 on NHI, Chair, as you may recall, the white paper was gazetted June 2017. It was submitted to Cabinet before the end of March, meaning in terms of our target of having it approved by Cabinet, we submitted on time. But when it was finally published, it was June 2017. But the minister also announced the establishment of 7 NHI implementation structures, and these were gazetted on the 7th of July 2017. And these are as follows: the Committee on Tertiary Services. This committee has implications for how tertiary services are run in the country, but also how they are funded. And it's a very important committee because we have the tertiary services, National Tertiary Services Grant, which we normally report on. I think there must be a link between, because at the moment it cannot be that as National Department of Health Services, okay, this is how funding should be. We want it to be a consultative process that involves provinces, tertiary institutions that provide training, but also other stakeholders, so that we have a much more inclusive process. I think this was what was intended. The second committee is on human resource for health. Our human resource for health is subject to review at the moment. We had a human resource for health in Durban as part of this consultation process. I think the idea here is also to look at how we plan for human resources, but how we finance human resources. Honorable members, you may be aware that a number of students are sent to different parts of the world, China, Russia, Turkey, Cuba. But I think the sad part is when they qualify, it's always a problem. That they qualify, some of them, if they're professional, regulated, specific occupations, they do their internships, some of them community service, but when they finish, they are not allocated posts. So it's something that we have to correct. So our human resource for health planning should address this particular issue. It can be that the country produces professionals, and after they qualify, they become unemployed. So it's something that is part of this human resource for health strategy. This time around, we correct. So this committee was intended to do that, and it would involve all different professional groupings, as well as the statutory bodies, and academic institutions, and community participation, as in NGOs. Because one particular category is about community health workers. Chair, you may recall that there was a presentation here about clinical associates, for instance. It's some of these problems that we'd like to resolve through this committee structure. That once we plan and we say these are the categories of health workers that must be trained, and these are the services that are needed, and these are services that are going to be rendered, we do it in that particular way. We don't train people, they have degrees and they sit at home with their degrees or certificates. The next category is about the healthcare benefits for NHI. Now, this is a technical work that is needed when you develop as a country, for instance, like you've seen in other countries like Turkey and so on. Before you even start, you must have done this background work to say what are the package of benefits going to be. You design it, you define it, you look at the population coverage and you cost it. And that exercise has been done. We had a work stream that was led by Dr. Jürgen Pille. He can give details of how much of this was done. The next is about the pricing advisory committee. You might have heard repeatedly the minister saying there are pricing concerns. The market inquiry has also identified the cost of healthcare as a concern. So we thought we needed a pricing advisory committee, meaning in the initial phases it must be advisory. And once we set up mechanisms, then we can start regulating, because then we'd have amended the law. If you recall, when we had the reference price list, the court actually struck off the provision in the National Health Act that allowed the department to regulate pricing. So now that we've got the report of the market inquiry, we can then use that as a basis of coming up with the provisions in legislation on how best we can regulate the private sector. The next one about consolidating of financing arrangements. Now, if you look, Chair, in the public sector alone, we've got multiple streams of funding and financing. For instance, the budget is appropriated. One set of funding stream will come through national, and then through the conditional grants, we'll then allocate money to provinces. But it's about a small proportion. Some funding comes directly from national treasury to provincial treasury, and some of the funding will go to municipalities or local governments. But we also have revenue streams that come through revenue collection, whether from hospitals and so on. And then you have donor funding. So there are actually multiple streams. So we need to consolidate it and have a much more logical way of how health is financed, even if we just do it in the public sector. I think that's a good start. And then we can then look at, from a private sector point of view, how this can be done. The next is about the health technology assessment. This is about particularly new technologies. I would like to cite an example. For instance, if you have a technology, let's say for cancer treatment, where it can be shown that, you know, there are benefits, people can stay alive longer, or people can live longer, or the quality adjusted life years are improved. So those kind of analyses are done by the health technology assessment. But we are making a case for how do you then determine whether a particular technology can be priced this high? And I want to use cancer as an example. We had a case in point where there are people who benefited about 9 patients, and they were paying 5,000 per treatment for a period of 6 months. It was a product that was unregistered. And once the product got registered, it was now at a cost of 75,000 per treatment for a period, meaning every month for 6 months, they had to pay 75,000. So we have to sort of have a much more better analysis of how do you arrive at 75, particularly if people were paying 5,000. So it means most people will not be able to afford this. Or even if government were to just move from 5,000 to 75,000, there must be a logical way, and we think the Health Technology Assessment Committee will help us do this analysis. The last one is the National Health Commission. This is aimed at helping us deal with the risks associated with non-communicable diseases, smoking, alcohol consumption that lead people to these risk factors, as well as good nutrition and physical activity. So the National Health Commission is supposed to coordinate a different, along the same lines as SANAC, but work with private sector, civil society, government, as well as labor. but come up with a much more logical approaches on how we can improve health in the country. So these are the committees that we had proposed that have been gazetted, and I think the minister can elaborate on this further. So, Chair, with regard to NHI, we've got the white paper. The bill went out for public comment. We've received a lot of comments, over 4,000 individuals have responded, and about 187 organizations have responded. So it's quite intense. So we have to analyze each and every one of those comments and look at what are the public saying about NHI and the bill, and before it even comes to Parliament, so that by the time Parliament holds public hearings, we've also taken into account all those comments and we've revised the bill before it's resubmitted to Cabinet. So medicine availability, I would like to pause here before I deal with this program to this particular issue, purely because there's been sort of headlines about ARVs and problems of shortage, and I'll allow Dr. Kibbe to just brief the committee on that, and then I'll get to the annual report
section. Honourable members, there was a problem with the production of one of the antiretroviral products called lamivudine. The active ingredient is produced in China, and the factories where they are produced were subject to the new environmental laws of China, resulting in them being closed down because the Chinese government was now being very strict with companies that pollute the environment. And so when these factories got shut down, the active ingredients that are linked to the production of lamivudine then became in short supply across the world. We managed to secure other supplies of the lamivudine-based ARVs. There are about 100,000 patients on the 107,000 on the zidovudine-based combination, and about another 130,000 on the abacavir-based combination. And these two products have now been secured, and over the past 2 weeks, we've been able to bring in about 300,000 units of the zidovudine-based and 450,000 of the abacavir-based. So we now have sufficient stock for the next 3 months, plus minus. So we've managed to secure that, as there's some negotiation between the Global Fund and the Chinese government about those factories that were shut down so that they can comply with the environmental laws but continue to produce the lamivudine that they were doing. Thanks, Tisha.
But in a more sustainable manner, there's been call, and I think it is this committee that asked us about the state-owned pharmaceutical industry. And the Department of Science and Technology has been leading the work on pilopepa. Get that pill. Oh, pilopepa is the train. I'm sorry. I'm confused. It's get that pill about the production of the active pharmaceutical ingredients so that we can maintain security of supply to avoid what happened in China. Even that, I think you can briefly tell the committee where we are with get that pill.
The Ketlapela initiative is with the Department of Science and Technology and Department of Energy. They have developed a business case, and the proposal of the business case is that they initially are responsible for supply of strategic ARVs and other drugs, and then we'll move into the area of production of these products, and then eventually into API production. The business case suggests that the cost of setting up an API plant like the ones that exist in China and India are highly unaffordable at this stage for them to be able to get the capital to do it. So the idea is to progressively move in that direction, to initially secure supplies of products that South Africa doesn't have or is always unstable, and through that process eventually get into production and then eventually into API production. So that's the business plan that the Department of Science and Technology and Department of Energy are working on.
Okay, thanks, Chair and Honourable Members. In fact, This system on medicine availability that we have, the SVS, is the one that has helped us to identify the shortage problems. Hence the plan to order medicines outside the cycle that was followed of using China as an API producer. But in addition, what we did, we spoke to WHO because they pre-qualify suppliers and products globally. They gave us a list of all the suppliers across the world that are WHO pre-qualified. So meaning 3 months down the line, we'll also monitor so that we don't have any gap whatsoever. We can then work with WHO and those suppliers that can give us a continued supply. But in terms of the targets in this particular area, we've met most of the targets. The next one, Chair, is about, I think it's the PMPU. We are supposed to have established two PMPUs, a provincial medicine procurement unit. We only had one in Northern Cape. The Mpumalanga one has still not been established. That's one area of underachievement. I've already mentioned that for medicine, one particular area of focus was for antimicrobial resistance. We have the strategy that has been developed. So for this particular period, we're supposed to come up with a system for monitoring resistance, a surveillance system. And I think that is on track. And the traditional health practitioners, we have a draft amendment bill, and it will not be ready for this sitting of Parliament because we must still go through public consultations and it must still go through Cabinet. But we do have a draft that we can share with honourable members. But for now, we're going through the normal cycle of public consultation. For Program 2, the e-health and information system, we have reviewed our e-health strategy, and one of the things that we wanted to do, honourable members, is that because we have introduced the HPRS, it's the system where we've enrolled patients, and as at 31st March, we had 20 million registered patients on the system. What we are busy doing is to integrate the system with the lab system, the pharmacy system, but also the district health information system. And we have a new version of the DHIS, which is web-based. And as of 31st of March, out of 1,759 facilities, we're able to capture data, whilst the remainder are still doing it at sub-district level because they need internet connectivity. So we're working with other relevant departments to help us achieve connectivity because it will make it easy to upload data immediately. Now, the way it happens now is that we have a system and people have to write down information and then sit down and capture the information. And we then have to find mechanism by which that information can be uploaded. And I think it introduces what I called input errors. And input errors sometimes are human errors, and it affects the quality of data. So we are hopeful that across the whole country we'll have connectivity. And of course, we rely on other government departments. Chair, the next one on single exit price, you may be aware that we review prices, medicine prices annually. There are always concerns about adjustments because of the fluctuation of the rand against the dollar. Suppliers sometimes argue that it affects their margins. But at the same time, it also makes medicines expensive for us when there is a rand-dollar exchange problem. So Dr. Pide will explain further. With regard to the treaties, we've actually met most of our targets. With regard to our multilateral as well as our bilateral agreements and the frameworks that we had to develop and projects, most are underway. As you may recall, honourable members, that in this past financial year, we're actually leading two, both plurilateral and multilateral arrangements. We're chairing SADC, and we had quite a lot of activities within the SADC region. And the second one was the BRICS. So we did SADC and BRICS, but we also do FOCAC. Now, we were leading these two, and we had quite a number of agreements and projects under these. For instance, the TB research projects that we did, but also in the SADC region, we did quite a number of programs, including training, and we're able to source funding from Global Fund for the SADC region for the cross-border activities for people who have HIV and AIDS, but also TB and TB in the mind. So we actually have detail about some of these initiatives. So under Program 2 on quality of care, we've done surveys to measure patient experience of care. We did this in our clinics and we did this in our hospitals. We developed guidelines, we developed norms and standards. These, we worked with the Office of Health Standard Compliance, and these will come into force from the 1st of March 2019. We also are part of the Global Commission, the Lancet Commission, and with 15 member countries. But what was also important is that South Africa also had a national commission with a few other countries, and each of these Lancet national commission. We, together with Mexico, Ethiopia, Senegal, Philippines, Argentina, Nepal, and Tanzania. It means we put quality as a priority, meaning in each country, in each of these countries, we say for universal health coverage to happen, quality must be prioritized, meaning quality must be embedded, meaning quality must be key. And for us to achieve NHI, we must ensure the quality. So we put quality first. So the patient experience of care, the surveys are available online.
Chairperson, can I try to explain, if I'm wrong, maybe the DG will also explain again, because it might be surprising why we're talking about the Global Lancet Commission, a global structure on the issue of quality. The problem, Chairperson, is at the moment, what actually is the definition of quality? When you say in this country there's quality health care, what actually do you mean? I'm posing this question, Chairperson, because can you go to, I need to be very careful, because some examples have caused problems in the past. Can you go to a very small country on the African continent and say they've got poor quality health care because you are comparing it with what's happening in the United States or Canada? You know, can you say that? Can you say, okay, I went to this hospital in England and this is what I found, and I came here to Kanyagwide in KZN, I did not find that, then there's poor quality. You know, so because of that, because it's all over the world, the Global Lancet Commission is to determine what they call quality for each and every country in the world in a scientific manner, and say for you in this part of the world to have said you have reached your quality, this is what you think you must achieve. It won't be the same as you are in Paris or in Berlin and all that. So that countries must be inspected in terms of their means, their history, their level of development, rather than just talking universally. That's the importance of this issue of Lancet Commission. And once it comes out, when you gauge us for quality, you won't be doing it in terms of what you feel, but you'll be doing it in terms of a scientific formula that has been set globally for each and every country. In other words, it's to set a standard for each country depending on their GDP, on their level of development, on their geography, on their history, etc., and on what the people there are experiencing. So I just thought I need to explain that part, because it's not the ordinary quality that you know. It's individualized. Yeah.
Thank you, Minister.
I was very hesitant when I said I choose a committee, a country, because Malawi came to my mind, but there was a bad example about roads in Malawi, that's why I ran away from it. But I wanted to give you just an example that you go to the center of New York, and what you find there, you want to find it in a hospital in Malawi, and say this hospital is performing very poorly, because some hospital in New York is at another level. That question has not been solved in the world, and the Lancet Commission is trying to resolve it.
Sorry, Minister, without saying Malawi, I just brought this article for MPs. This is an article of the Kenyan members of parliament. They say they've got 63 MPs in Kenya that are battling cancer. And they give the statistics, the numbers, the concerns, the problems. So I thought I should just share this with you. That again, cancer is a problem in South Africa, but here it's received attention by specific members of parliament because they are making it their campaign. And I thought I should just share this with you. Dr. Andrews appoint people to conduct these surveys. Honorable members, why we do the surveys is because we don't want to use subjective measures about how people view our care or how they experience care. It must be objectively determined. There must be, if there are complaints, we must understand what complaints there are. If there are compliments, we need to understand so that we can strengthen those areas. But we also want to manage the safety incidents that happened, that normally happen in our facility. So we do this jointly with them. With provinces, we've developed guidelines, we conduct surveys, so we've done them in hospitals and clinics, and we're going to do this on an annual basis, and I'll ask Dr. Andrews to share the two reports. Under Program 3 on HIV and AIDS, the child, adolescent and maternal health, as you may recall, we introduced Mom Connect, and it continues to give us information about how women, particularly those who visit antenatal services, experience care. So far we've got over 1 million, about 1.8 million pregnant women and mothers who have visited our facilities and who use the system, but who also share their experience. Dr. Pide will say how many are happy and how many are not happy. And with Integrated School Health Program, about 387,574 grade 1 learners and 193,438 grade 8 learners were screened from April 2017 to March 2018. So a cumulative total of over 4 million have been screened since the inception. And we had actually said in this financial year we want to at least help the 500,000 learners with those barriers to learning, because if we don't intervene now, it means later in the year they will experience these difficulties. But they will become a burden anyway to the health system. With regard to HPV, the eligible girls in 2017-18 was 82.6% for the first dose. The second dose is always lower, and we struggle with that, and Dr. Pide will elaborate what these difficulties are and the seasonal problems. Honorable members, for HIV, HPV, so a total of 13.8 million people were tested for HIV, and this is above our target of 10 million. And over the years, I mean, since 2010, we've actually conducted about 44 million tests. And it's quite heartening that people continue to use the service so that they know their status. But as to those who are remaining of antiretroviral therapy, we've got about 4.2 million people roughly who remain on treatment. And infants that are infected with HIV, as in 2017-18, the PCR tests that are done at 10 weeks show that a 0.95 positivity rate is the case, meaning we've gone below the 1% mark. Remember, our target is to reach zero, and I think we're sort of slowly getting there. For TB, the client...
Before TB, Chairperson, I think I need to add this because I want members of Parliament to understand. The statistics that DG is mentioning is very problematic for us, the figures. Because these people are overwhelmingly women. We're struggling to get men on this issue of testing. That's why on the SES program, which the President mentioned during the State of the Nation, we specifically said we are going to target men. We just can't get them to budge. On Saturday last week, I went to represent the Deputy President in a church in Limpopo where there was a conference. And he was invited. Unfortunately, he left the country. And I asked SANAC that because there will be many people, they must come there before the church service starts, test. You know, they came with their vans and tested. Unfortunately, the church service started when they've only tested 102 million people. Sorry. Oh, my God. When they've just tested 102 people, out of 102, only 5 were men. That's how bad the situation is. And yet, they were coming to the same church to wait for the same priest. When they said it's time to test, all the women stand up. He said, please test before we get into the church. Now, I visited that church last year. They asked me to address them. I asked all the men to stand up, and I reprimanded them about this thing. That was last year. I'm back a year later. The situation is still the same. Men in the country are causing us a big problem on this. Perhaps as political leaders, you might have a way to help us. Many of them, when you ask them, they said, no, but my wife has tested. I don't have to test. Same as in the church, and I was telling the bishop in that church. When you ask, why are there so many women in the church, there are no men. The men will tell you, no, but my wife goes to church on behalf of the family. So we do have a problem of male species in fighting some of these pandemics. I just wanted the House to know that. Remember, in 2010, after testing 18 million people, 65% were female, 5% were children, and only 30% were men. Despite the fact that we even go to their place, the places of work, where you'll say most of the employed people are men. So it's a national problem.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you,
Minister.
TB, our treatment success rate is at 84.4%, while our death rate is 3.9%. Honorable members, we'd like to increase the treatment rate and the success thereof, as well as reduce the death rate. And for us to achieve that, we need to find the missing case, meaning those people who have TB, and that search must be almost like in a form of campaign, because the more we get them and put them on treatment, the more we'll prevent death. And I think this is sort of our campaign at the moment. For maternal child and women's health, I just wanted to highlight two areas. The first is on slide 28. About nutrition strategy, that it was approved, and we are busy costing it so that we can get appropriate nutrition for mothers, newborns, children, adolescents, and women. And in doing this, we're hoping that this strategy, because it's supposed to be implemented starting from this year, going up to the 2021-2022 financial year, but we also have to ensure that there's budget to implement some of the activities in the strategy. For EPI coverage, South Africa was assessed, and there are specific areas of improvement that we had to focus on, and it is for that reason that we came up with a coverage a strategy, but also to conduct a survey so that we can identify where the problems are. You know, from time to time we hear about measles outbreak, and our polio program, we're actually supposed to be one of the countries that are leading, and so that we can get certified. But we have to first look at our coverage rate and look at where the resources are going specifically for the EPI program. With regard to the next one about patient retention and treatment for TB, I spoke about TB in general, our success rate, but there are two key areas that are important that I wanted to flag. The MDR TB, we've got 18 MDR TB treatment initiation facilities that we had planned for. This is mainly to put people on bitaquiline, and now we've got 22 of these, and I think it will help us reduce the rate of MDR TB infection in our facility. And we also have hospitals that are implementing fast, and 15 of these were targeted and reached 17. So there's actually a progress, and we've been meeting our targets, but we'll scale up our efforts in this financial year. So the HIV strategic plan, as honorable members may recall, is work that we do with SANAC and partners, and one of the areas we're saying, if we're to succeed, each district must have an implementation plan. This will help us reach 90-90-90, not just for HIV, but also for TB. That's why we've been referring to the district implementation plan. And I just thought I needed to flag this. Sometimes people think, if you write development of district implementation plan, why do we see that as an important thing? Implementation happens at that level, and if those plans are not developed and if they are not robust, we'll never reach these targets and we'll never reach 90-90-90. For primary health care, as at end of March 2018, we had 1,507 facilities that were ideal, and this has been enabled because of the collaboration between ourselves and Treasury. There's been problems with supply chain management, particularly with regard to equipment and essential supplies, in some instances, infrastructure. So we asked Treasury to work with us to help us at least achieve these. With regard to environmental health, there's been a total of 20 districts and metropolitan municipalities that render municipal health services. In fact, I want to pause a bit and ask Ms. Kaele to just explain how we worked with municipalities, particularly during the listeriosis outbreak, because it was such an example where you can actually get the municipal health services working. The second one was, I think, in relation to fake news that were in the media.
Thanks, DG. Honorable members, yes, in terms of engagement with municipalities, we actually, environmental health practitioners are all employed by either metropolitan municipalities or district municipalities. In terms of the powers of inspecting and visiting the facilities, it lies at that level. So if ever in case of this outbreak, we had to engage municipalities to go out and do inspections. So they have been handy in terms of going and visiting all the facilities
that were actually identified, especially processing plants. But also with regards to the fake food, also we relied on their engagement in relation to them going out there, tracing all the complaints that were coming through the social media. So they've been instrumental in terms of engaging and going out, visiting all facilities, be it the tuck shops, be it the formal food shops that are out there, inspecting them and tracing all the things that might be affecting or in terms of the relevance and how these facilities, whether they are complying with the environmental health standards.
Thank you, Ms. Kwele. Honorable members, you've asked us two questions repeatedly. The first one is about the functionality of the primary health care clinic committee. You've raised this to say, how do we determine whether they're functional or not? And we've been working on this to make sure that they're functional, and at least we've got now 3,437 of these. And you've also asked us a question about the ward-based primary health care outreach team as to how many of these are functional. And we actually will show you in the guidelines that we've developed how we determine functionality and how we assess them. And equally for the those that we say they are ideal, I remember Honorable Patrick Matalela saying, show me this ideal, I've not seen it, I need to see it. We can actually give you a list and show you which ones they are. But I've also asked the teams, when we were last here, you had asked us, you know, will we be conducting audits again? What we did, we actually developed a self-assessment tool, meaning the facilities assess themselves first. But these tools are online. But because when you self-assess, it's subjective. You can score yourself too high, or you can punish yourself, depending on your perspective. So to try and manage this, we conduct peer reviews, meaning we'll get teams from different provinces to assess a different province, meaning you'd have assessed yourself. But when they do the peer review, they will then tell you that whether what you rated yourself, you know, the score you allocated yourself is good or not. And they will give you an objective score. And this is sort of how we are using these measures. I think this has also helped us to prevent what I had described when I last presented, where if they know that there's going to be a visit, then they borrow equipment from next door so that they look good. Now, the peer review prevents that. You can't do that when you do peer review because the facilities, meaning you are not peer reviewed by National, it's actually other colleagues who are doing similar work like you do. The only thing we give them tools who do that. So this information is available online. Chair will be doing a similar kind of exercise with hospitals. We'll start with the 50, like we shared the report with you. We'll start with the 50 that we've already visited ourselves. For environmental health services, Ms. Kwele has already referred to this. With regard to NCDs, we worked with other government departments to come up with guidelines. What we're trying to do is to at least agree on what kind of healthy meals they should provide. For instance, there are those who have canteens at the workplace. We say these are sort of healthy options that they must consider. So we had a orientation, for instance, with the offices of the Premier, Treasury, Department of Transport, Sports, Arts and Culture, Agriculture, and so on. So we did this with some of the provinces, but at national it was only three government departments, education, social development, and ourselves. The area that is still a problem is the early childhood
level, in that the guidelines for early childhood development, as you know, one, we have to regulate the use of infant formula. So it's very difficult for us to go to every crèche, every nursery, kindergarten, and check whether they give children formula milk or not, and so on. But the regulations are clear as to how this should be done. The next one is about regulation relating to labeling and packaging of tobacco products and smoking in indoor and outdoor places. We've got actually a bill, and it has gone out for public comment, and we will be effecting some changes, and it will go back to cabinet with a plan to table it in parliament. Mental health, Chair, the number of districts that have come developed teams, our target was 10, we've got 14. 14 is still, to be honest, it's still very, very low, because we've got 52 districts. Now, 14 out of 52 is still very low, given that mental health is a priority. So we'll obviously have to go back and look at how we can help provinces to set up these. Obviously, the general complaint is that there are budgetary constraints. They can't come up with these things. But we are arguing that mental health is a priority, and we probably have to work with Treasury and see how best there can be reallocation. For the epidemic preparedness, particularly for zoonotic diseases, for infections and foodborne diseases, we do see outbreaks from time to time. The one that I think which is over, and maybe the minister might have had the minister saying that listeriosis outbreak is over. But we did have not so long Klebsiella outbreak in some of our hospitals because of poor infection control measures. And the one which we must be on the lookout for is the Ebola, precisely because where currently the outbreak is in DRC, it's at the border of Uganda and Rwanda, and we actually get a lot of migration from these countries to South Africa. So our port of health officials, they are actually on alert. You'll see they're screaming. When you come, they check whether you've got temperature or not, because that's a sign. If you do, they detain you, so you can't go beyond. We actually have a system. Anybody coming from DRC must fill in a form when they come to South Africa. So that form will tell us what your status is, which areas you've been to, and so on. So it's pretty tight for DRC, but the problem is because it's the risk of spreading to Rwanda and Uganda is that it means you must then introduce measures for those two countries as well. It's a big risk, and it's of concern. In fact, today or tomorrow there will be an announcement that is an outbreak of public health of international importance, meaning countries must all be on high alert because it can hit any country like we saw with West Africa. With regard to flu, we've covered vaccination for almost 797 high-risk individuals for organ transplantation. There are guidelines, in fact, regulations that we've come up with for dialysis and organ transplantation. The minister gets a request almost daily for people who want to undergo organ transplantation. And we just want to have a much more regulated environment. With regard to malaria, the indoor residual spraying need to be increased because we've seen that, particularly in Limpopo, there's been an upsurge, and it's a bit of a concern because we're allocated the elimination status. We were one of the 8 countries that were in the elimination phase. Now, with this upset in Limpopo, it sort of undermines that kind of status. So we have to work with the neighboring countries that are affected by malaria, but also strengthen our response, particularly in those regions that are severely affected. Under Program 5, we had to finish the nursing curriculum. It has been finished, and the graduates will be clinically trained, and they will be service-oriented, but they will be general nurses. They'll be able to manage low-risk health problems along a continuum of care. So 8 of the 17 public nursing colleges have been supported to develop this curriculum. We're hoping that next year most of them will be ready. There are a few areas that need further work. For instance, infrastructure, I've visited some of them. They really need to beef up their infrastructure for them to meet the requirements. Our chief nursing officer has been driving this agenda. Staffing norms for PAC level, yes, Minister.
I just thought I needed to expand on these issues because as members of parliament, I've got a suspicion that some of you might be approached by individuals who claim a lack of consultation, because to me this is a very big issue. The issue of nursing, Chairperson, how nurses are trained in the country. The complaint has always been about, you know, the university training of nurses, the destruction of nursing colleges in the country. There's been a call that we need to rebuild the nursing colleges. And there is sort of confusion as to what that means. What the report means is that, you know, this issue took us 8 years, starting with a big conference of summit, I mean to say, which was opened by the president at Sandton Convention Center in 2011. We have been working, consulting, and fighting. We finally reached an agreement that the type of nursing training that was there before 1987 is the one that we need. I'm sure as a nurse chairperson, you may understand more than other members. You remember that nursing curricula in the country changed in 1987. And when democracy came, many people thought it was changed by democracy. It was already 3 years in the making, where nurses go to university or to any college, even outside the hospital, spend 4 years and come up with 4 bars here and all that. That has caused us problems in terms of nursing techniques and all that. So this new curriculum, number one, it won't happen outside the hospital. We won't agree that you will just find a building somewhere, a former teacher training college, and open it and say it's a nursing college. If you want to train a nurse, it must be inside the hospital by the bedside. That's number one. Number two, 60% of the time of the training of that nurse must happen inside the hospital ward, and only 40% in some lecture hall somewhere, you know, when you train a nurse. Number three, after 4 years of training, that nurse will come up with a maroon, epaulette, and a bar. You remember the bar of midwifery, not 4 bars, where you just go for 4 years, you know. Sorry? Yes, those who had them before 1987 took 7 years to acquire them. But in the curriculum of 1987, which started in 1987, you just spend 4 years, you already come with all of them. So I'm warning you that in this bedside experience, you spend 3 years general training, you get the maroon appellate. You would then go for another year full. Then you are a midwife, then you get the bar, which is green. Then you say you are a nurse now. That's, yes. Rather than, yes, That's why I'm saying some who don't like it will come to you and complain. Because that's how nursing used to be, by the way. It's how it used to be, and there were no problems in that. So that's what we are going back to. Now, we did not just wake up. After all these debates and consultation, we piloted this in three provinces. That's Mpumalanga, Free State, and was it KZN? Yes. Yes, we went back and say the curriculum of nurses that used to be there before 1987, do we still have the tutors? Can we still be able to do it? Can we afford it? You can't just say we are going to open colleges without that. So for 3 years, we've been piloting, checking the tutors, their level, and all that. And that has been completed. And a dossier has been put together, sent to the nursing council for approval. And the nursing council approved it. What will then the universities, that's a diploma. The universities will still continue to train nurses, but at the degree level, right? And also, they won't be allowed to train somebody for 4 years and let them come up with a lot of bars here. They'll still come up with only one bar. If they want the other bar, they must work for them for the next coming years. And that will be a degree level, but with one bar. Because, Chairperson, why we do this? We told you we've got problems with midwives. You are a nurse, you can't train midwife for 3 months or 6 months. But in the previous curriculum, that was what was happening. So in this one, whether you are at university or not, midwifery, inside the labor ward, in the neonatal unit, must be a one-year course. I just thought I needed to explain that. Now, next year, we take the last group of the nurses who were trained in this new method, which the country kept for 31 years. Since 1987. It's the last group. And we are discouraging province from taking many people. It's the last group because we want them to prepare for the new one, which will start in 2020. Only in 2020 will we start the intake of a new nurse and stop a 31-year practice, which we believe deviated our quality care nursing in the country. I met the professor who is coordinating the nursing colleges inside the country. It looks like the university one won't be ready until 20, I don't know whether it's 2022 or 2023. The university one, where they'll also train and get one by, will all be ready. So the intake will be in our colleges. Why am I saying there is war? Because some people in the universities don't like this thing, which we are doing. They still believe we must send everybody to university to sit in a lecture hall, and you know. So there is this war, there is lobbying, and some of the university people are fighting, and I understand they even go to the president, that this thing is going to be dangerous. Now, what worries me, that's why I'm telling you, they even wrote to the presidency to say the minister did not consult, and whenever there is a meeting of health somewhere, there is a group which raised this issue because they don't want it. Now, what frustrates me, Chairperson, is in 2009 when I came in as a minister, there was a new curriculum of nurses which was supposed to start in 2013. Yes. Because people were aware all this time that this 1987 thing has got problems. Now, whether a group of people will ask for a meeting and say, Minister, hey, this 2013 thing, don't even venture there. It's very dangerous. Don't. If you do that, nursing is finished. When you digest it, another group comes in and say, Minister, that 2013 thing, we want it now. We have agreed and all that. So I said, let's stop everything, start from the beginning, consult. And that's why we had this summit in 2010, which I call the Codex of Nursing. And we said before that summit, each province must have its own provincial summit. And provinces did have those summits. Then we went to the national one. We divided them into 7 commissions. One was about this curriculum. I attended it, and I know the all the of these various qualifications when they were fighting each other as to which one must the state adopt, because each one wanted the state to adopt the one in which they passed, and it was a big problem. From there, we took another period consulting. So it's 8 years, and now that we are at the end and people start writing to the president, it worries us. What more do we do as a country? Can you go back and start building and having summit again for another 8 years when we took 8 years. That 8 years include the piloting. And we did not do a shortcut in the pilot. We said, if basic nursing takes 3 years, then the piloting must take 3 years. 1 year after the other, and it turns out to say, I've done everything according to book, I didn't take shortcuts. Now, those who said we must consult again and write to the president, chairperson, I don't think it's fair to the country. I'm sure you are waiting for a new dawn when it comes to nursing training. And this is the new dawn that will dawn in 2020. Next year is a preparatory year. Whatever number provinces take, I got information that Gauteng is not even going to take one person in preparation. And I forgot the fourth one. In that old method, where even a teacher training college can just be emptied, nurses trained, there were a lot of colleges of nursing, each with its principal. You find that in one province, they've got six colleges of nursing, each with its principal, and they are producing different nurses. In this new method, we told every province, and they finalized that work last month. We said each province must just have one college of nursing with one principal. The rest are satellites reporting to that big one. What's happening in one satellite must happen in the other. You can't have so many colleges with different qualities. So each province now has got one college of nursing, which will be called Gauteng College of Nursing, Western Cape College of Nursing, Limpopo College of Nursing, only one, with a director who is the principal. The rest everywhere will be satellite. We don't choose for them. And that one will have a head office. When they say Gauteng College of Nursing, they give you an address. That's the head office. And they'll give you the satellite. So I thought this is a very important thing to give to the members, because they need to understand. Because my suspicion is when people go to president, the next port of call is you here. They'll be coming and say, yeah, no, I was not fully consulted, this is bad and all that. So that's where we are. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. On behalf of the DG, in continuing chairperson, she will be joining us shortly. Maybe I should pause. Yes.
My apologies, Chair, Honourable Members. So, Chair, there are these areas of underperformance which I would like to highlight. The first is about hospitals that have achieved performance. We had set ourselves to reach 43 hospitals, and we reached 37. So we didn't reach the target of 43, particularly in regional hospitals. Instead of 20, we were only able to reach 40. With regard to central hospitals, we wanted to come up with a standardized organizational structure, in fact, for all 10. But we wanted implementation in 3. So when this matter was discussed, it was clear that we needed funding for this to be achieved, and because of budget constraints, the 3 that were identified, the provinces expressed concerns that they will not be able to unless there was additional funding. So it means we will only reach this, but it's something that is desirable because it is actually the Department of Public Service Administration that developed these structures, organizational structures for us, and it was quite an intense process that they followed. With regard to the district hospitals, we were supposed to benchmark staffing normative guides. Remember, we were doing the clinics. We finished, and this was running parallel to the hospitals. So we said when we do WISEN for hospitals, we start with districts. We're supposed to start with 30. And I must say up front that this was not achieved. Well, okay. For the next one, Chair, for the rest of the other areas, we have met our targets. And I wanted to highlight the ministerial task team for the expanded academic integration program. This was led by the deputy minister, and most of the targets under this program were achieved. You probably realize that there were a lot of students that came back from Cuba, and we haven't seen report complaints, and the deputy minister continues to lead this program. Under the nursing qualification, I think this the minister elaborated on and explained. For the infrastructure, honorable members, yeah, this is a difficult part, but we can explain the performance here and the difficulties. And I'll start with the facilities that were meant to be refurbished, maintained, and repaired, particularly in those areas that we attempt NHI pilot districts. We had a target of 197, and we only finished 107, meaning we couldn't finish about 90 of these. This is work that was largely driven by the national team, meaning out of 197, we could only do 107. But there was also other maintenance, repair, and refurbishment that had to be done outside NHI pilot districts, and these were largely led by provincial technical people. And you can see there's been gross underperformance. And we are trying to see how we can support the provinces in this particular regard. With regard to the clinics, about 42 clinics and community health centers were supposed to be either constructed or revitalized, and we only reached a target of 27 clinics and community health centers that were either constructed or revitalized. For the hospitals, we are supposed to revitalize 8, and we only have 1, and we'll elaborate further on these. The facilities that must comply, at least for the new infrastructure or new buildings, they have to comply with the norms and standards that we developed. And at least we are on track now. I don't think we'll be getting any poor quality buildings based on this normative framework that has been developed. For the EMS...
Before you go to EMS... Okay. Yes. Chairperson, I thought it would be important for me to elaborate on slide number 46, because I'm quite distressed. It's quite distressing, Chairperson. And I don't know. Yes, I don't know who interpret in the other languages, but I'm just seeing, I'm reading a verse from the Bible where you're lost, looking up at the mountain for your salvation. I don't know where our salvation will come from. If you look at that page, what it's reflecting is what we went through, especially over the past 3 years. Everybody in the country talks about health having collapsed. There are two main areas where we're having a problem in health. It's human resources, it's infrastructure. Because over the past 3 years, public health system lost 9 billion rand, and the private healthcare system gained 11 billion from the fiscals of the country. I just want to explain this, because when people attack us and attack NHI, they don't consider these things. Yes, the subsidies and the tax credits and all that to people who use private hospitals, unfortunately, all of us in this room are culprits in that. Over the past 3 years, we were given 11 billion, but the public health care system, saving 84% of the population, lost 9 billion, and that money was lost in human resources and infrastructure. That's why you see that there. You know, if you look at those hospitals where we say 8 hospitals constructed or revitalized, there's only one which was supposed to be new, the Limpopo Academic Hospital, which we've been fighting. And because our argument, Chairperson, maybe to take a little bit of a diversion, but which is important. You know there are 8 medical schools in the country, in South Africa. A medical school and a teaching hospital are supposed to be conjoined twins with the same design and all that, more or less the same building, but with different wings. That is happening except in medical schools which originally were built for black people. That's University of Natal, which is now Nelson Mandela School of Medicine, where I studied. It started in 1953. If you go there, a university was started without any hospital. King Edward, the hospital, was never a teaching hospital. It was a district hospital. They just attached to it. That was in 1953. Fast forward, 1973. Go to Garangua, Medunsa was built. No hospital was ever built. Garangua Hospital was never a teaching hospital. It's now called George Mukari. It was a small district hospital for a black settlement outside Pretoria called Garangua, which started in the 70s. And the Fed will train your doctors in here. That was 1973. Fast forward 1985, Mthatha, we established UNIT, university called University of the Transkei, with a medical school. You don't build a hospital. You then go and build and look for Mthatha Central Hospital and say this will be a teaching hospital. I want you to understand this system. Now we have opened a 9 medical school in Limpopo when we demerged Medunsa and University of Limpopo, if you remember. We said Limpopo must get its own medical school. They are in their 3rd year. And I said we can't repeat what we have done for 60 years. That every time you go to black areas, you do this thing, but when you go to white areas, that's not what happened. You can go and check if you don't believe it. You can check Grootegeluk and University of Cape Town, Stellenbosch and Tigerberg, Charlotte Maxeke, which was University of Johannesburg and Wits. You can go and check Free State, what is that? University of Free State with Universitas. They are all linked. It's only these three. Then I said, we must start a process of correcting 60 years of wrongdoing. All this that were not built, we should. We are correcting now. Unfortunately, we never got money for that. We knocked at the treasury door until they said, okay, let's start with a new one. Because I said, it's even more embarrassing even for us to start a new one and repeat the same mistake. So that Limpopo Academy, we said, at least this one, let's start afresh. It's only last week that we've been reaching a letter after 4 years of to and fro with that treasury might make funds available, but the other three are still standing. Now, these 8 here are not totally new. When we started NHI in the NHI pilot project, we found that in the areas, especially the former independent homelands, specifically Venda and the former Transkei, which means it's OR Tambo and Vembe district, there are hospitals there, we are so dilapidated that you can't refurbish them, you have got to build them afresh, you know. And we started that program. That was Sidom Hospital, Chilizini, Elim, that's in Limpopo, it's Bambisani in Eastern Cape and Zitulele. And then in Gauteng, we thought we needed a hospital north of Pretoria. Because if you go to George Mukari, with the teaching hospital, it's overcrowded with work that should have been done at the lower level. We said we need a new hospital to the north of Pretoria called Soshanguve Hospital. In the Free State is the Tabeng Hospital in the, Thaba Mofutanyane district. Now, unfortunately, the one where we have done this refurbishment and finished, that's why we say one there, is the Tabeng. All these others, financial constraints, including in Sidom where we have already started, we have finished accommodation first for nurses and doctors. It is there and we are very happy about it. When we are supposed to start the building, Treasury came with a new system called SIPD, Strategic Infrastructure Procurement Delivery and Management System. And they said go and start from the scratch and apply this new system, which has got 9 modules in it. And they said it's to stop corruption. Of course, when I read those modules, I agree. They said there's been a lot of corruption in infrastructure. We will never allow any province to go to the second phase of any building until they finish that module and submit it. And then we tell them to go ahead. They said it will stop corruption. I agree with that wholeheartedly. My gripe is that I believe when you start with a new law in a country, you don't apply it retrospectively. You apply it on new things that were coming. So we said, because here these hospitals have already started, allow us to continue. They said, no, but you're going to continue and if there's corruption. So we had to start with, you know, go back to follow those modules. We're now ready after a long time, and I think the tender will eventually be out in December. So I just want to explain for you to understand the journey we overtook on this issue of construction and revitalization of hospitals. But the main one, the cutting of the budget. You might have heard that Gauteng went to an extent of writing to us on the conditional grant to allow them to use infrastructure money and divert it for goods and services, because they had huge accruals, if you remember. And it means stopping any new infrastructure program that is coming. So that's where we are, and my distress stems from that, because I want this infrastructure program. We then have starting to negotiate that in the president's stimulus program of 400 billion rand infrastructure, we want all our clinics and hospitals that were supposed to be revitalized during these 3 years when money was taken away to at least be included in there, because this constitutes a crisis for us, a very big crisis. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. With regard to the EMS, I think we've met most of the targets, including the monitoring system, to establish whether provinces are on track or not. For the backlog on blood alcohol tests, we Chair, have conducted the test. And Dr. Andrews will explain that if you look at our audit outcomes, then this our discussion with the auditor general, the lab do the test and the supervisor must sign that the tests are done. And that process, the time lag between when the tests are done and the signature, I think there's been a gap. And this is a purely a supervisory issue that Dr. Andrews will refer to. So our records are that we have met the targets, but from the audit point of view, the AG says that supervisor's signature is a problem. So I think we just need to strengthen a management and supervision, because that seems to be the problem. The second, Chair, was with regard to the MOU that had to be signed with the Department of Transport, particularly for roadside testing programs. So this is supposed to be rolled out when the pilot was concluded. The similar problem with the food test, I think, is the same. About the approval process and supervision. Chair, for instance,
excuse me, on this issue. Number one, the political level, Chair, because people always point fingers at us, expand your laboratories and all that. And I'm not saying we shouldn't, but I don't think we must solve problem of drunkenness in the laboratory. There is just too much alcohol consumption and it's growing. The moment we deal with this, I mean, our laboratories literally receive 2,000 drunken driving, what he calls, per month. The more you test, the more they get drunk. Surely you don't solve that by expanding laboratory. I mean, we even built an extra laboratory in Durban, increased the staffing by 90%. There's no way in health where we increase staffing by 90%. We did so in the toxicology laboratory, but the backlog keep on piling. So why am I doing so? I'm lobbying you. When we bring legislation here to reduce alcohol, please stand with us, because we are being fought left, right, and center. There is a lot of alcohol in this country, which is being consumed, and you can't solve it by expanding laboratories. You have got to stop it. That's number one. Number two, I just want to expand on the issue of roadside testing, which the DG has said. You might remember that there was a system called REGA, which was used very effectively in the Western Cape, which was used on the roadside. It was challenged in court. And during that period when it was being challenged, we thought we need to put some mini laboratories around the roads together with the Department of Transport. But while we're still planning, the Western Cape issue went to court and the government won. The judges accepted that that REGA system is a reliable method of testing for alcohol. And you find it very affordable. In fact, if this REGA is there, you can use it on the road. Why do you go and put very expensive systems? Because the court has now allowed it. In other words, they were challenging its validity in court. When you produce it, they said, no, this thing is not valid. But now it's accepted as valid in court. We still have to go back to the Department of Transport and say, do we add more additional expensive methods when the courts have allowed this one where you do it much faster and it's very mobile and you can take it around? That explains that, that small gap there. Thank you. But the issue of alcohol, Chairperson, please agree with us. No more certificates for Shebeens and all that. Please.
Thank you, Minister. Chair, the next slide is about forensic pathology services. You may recall that we've had a lot of labor actions in this particular case, which has actually disadvantaged communities. They couldn't bury their loved ones on time. So what we did, because I think the dispute was about whether the forensic pathology officers are allowed to dissect or not, and whether it was within their scope of practice. So we worked with them, we developed the regulations, but we also came up with the scope of practice guidelines, and we consulted the Health Professions Council to say what a pathologist can do and what a support personnel should do and can do. We have concluded that, and we also signed an agreement with them about what is it that should be done and what can be done, what is allowable and what is not allowable. I think it has brought about labor peace, but we're still of the view that they need to be trained, and provided with a lot of support, because one of the problems that we identified was that the forensic pathology officers did not have a personal protective equipment, for instance, gloves and so on. Sometimes they had to use plastics when they have to go and collect corpses. I mean, those kind of things. So we've gone back to investigate this and come up with a corrective action. And this monitoring system has been developed specifically to move from mortuary to mortuary and look at exactly whether there's compliance or not. So the next one, honorable members, is a matter that is topical, and we've added this specifically because we want health facilities that are specifically designated to render services for the management of sexual and related offences. Because if you just use any facilities, they don't have a proper system of recording, you know, the particularly rape cases, and be able to share that with the police, and it always undermines these cases. And our view is that it's better if we have dedicated. Actually, we used to have such facilities, but because of funding, they were donor funded. Tutu Zellers, I think you might be familiar with those. Our worry about Tutu Zellers is that funding is going to be ending, and when funding ends, it means this service will come to an end, but these problems persist. You've seen the marches, the shutdowns, the Me Too, and all these other campaigns that there's no way we can as a country not have this service. So we started this work, and we will be producing as to which facilities are rendering these services and so on. The next one is about coaching of managers. Chair, we had
a chief director that was managing this program in the past financial year, who developed a hub for the training of managers and hospital managers and health facility managers. If you look at the achievement, it's very low. He was subject to a disciplinary action and he resigned abruptly. So this work has sort of was almost like it came to a complete halt. So we have to reprogram again because he developed this hub and a system for the training of these managers. And when he left the department, when he was subject to an investigation, it affected this program significantly. So we'll work with other partners to provide the training of managers and CEOs. A chair for program six, SAPRA has been established. It has a board. I think they should have been here to present. The two bills, NAPISA and the NHLS, they are also before Parliament. All these entities have been here to present. I would not like to repeat what we did with SAPRA. We signed an MOU because there are certain functions. If you read the Medicines Act, that still says Minister or Director General. And for them to be able to perform those functions on behalf of the Minister or on behalf of the DG, we'll have to either sign the MOU or look at what is legislatively possible, like for instance in the form of regulation. The NAPISA and NHLS, like I said, they are in Parliament at the moment. For human resource management, I've already referred to this, that our vacancy rate is at this level, 12.5%, but deliberately so because we are managing the budget tightly. On financial management, our expenditure is actually 99.5%. Like, I wanted to flag the irregular expenditure and wasteful expenditure, which I would like the CFO to refer to. But I'd also like two of the DDG who are affected to just share with us, particularly with those irregular expenditure, what are the issues, so that we can have an opportunity to indulge and engage members. For material variances, under administration program one, it was mainly delays in the renewal of software licenses and the lease contract for forensic chemistry lab. For NHI, it was mainly because of the medicine stock system. Dr. Pillay will tell you that the system is actually a system that Treasury is implementing across the country. It's a transversal system. When it was developed, it has serious programming problems. The pilot was conducted in Northern Cape. When it was done, when we were supposed to roll out the system, it was problematic. So we had to make a choice between implementing a system that is flawed and spend money or hold back the money until the problems were corrected. Our view was the latter, that they fix the system and based on that then we implement. So we've just started now. We've assigned for the donation of computers to provinces and so on, but we could not have implemented the system. I think the risk here was under expenditure, but at least not risk paying for a system that does not work. That was our problem. And the ideal clinic realization, there was delay with the provincial reviews that I referred to. And this is the expenditure per economic classification. I think if you look, on other areas, we are 100%, and in two, it's 94 and 95, particularly goods and services. The processing of invoices, like I said, for Ideal Clinic, and the expenditure, the DRGs, because it's linked to NHI, there was also a delay. So I'll hand over to the CFO just to talk about the irregular expenditure and the key findings, but also to say what are those technical areas of concern and how are we dealing with them. And then we'll get to the conditional one.
Chair, thanks. So on the irregular expenditure, you'll find it on page 183 of the annual report, on note 183 of the annual report. Mm. So we have 77.5 million as it stands. We have self-reported three incidents of this. The other incidents comes from interpretation by the AG, and obviously we had technical evaluation on that, and we had to consider those. But let me run through them quickly. So the first one was a self-reported instance on the HISP, on the ISP. We contacted the services as an addendum to an existing contract, of which we realized that you know, we had to probably have to go onto a supply chain management process to secure that specific service. It was in terms of the HPV contracting. Page 183. The other one was a small amount of 216,000 rand on infrastructure. It was initially disapproved and paid. We have approved it afterwards, and this is a matter that can easily be condoned by the accounting officer. The next one was, again, a self-reported amount of 39,000 rand, which we exceeded the treasury's threshold for insurance cover of vehicles. And again, it's something that we will condone through the accounting officer process. The three amounts that make up the bulk of the irregular was, again, for ISP of 15 million, HST of 13.3 million, and HP contracting of 32.9. The ISP and the HST ones were directly linked to a circular that was issued by National Treasury on the 28th of May. Number one, it's very late in the financial year. We've already concluded our financials. Secondly, we only came to know of the circular around July, when the AG informed us, and essentially what this says is that some NGOs are classified as transfer payments, but in terms of this circular, it has to be classified as goods and services. So the AG took a view that the entire expenditure that we transferred over to these two NGOs should be regarded as irregular. Now, subsequent to this, we have written to Treasury, the Accountant General, to get clarity on this matter, because there is a sense that they want to apply this retrospectively going backwards, which means that this could even go up to 2013-14 financial year. So we've asked them for clarity on this matter, and as I said, you know, it's a very technical aspect that came through quite late. The big amount of 32.9 was an overspend on a component of the indirect grant. So you will see that when you look at our audit opinion, it talks about emphasis of matter that we've grossly underspent one aspect of the grant on the information systems, but this aspect was overspent on the same grant. The total grant was not overspent, but the view of the AG was that because the Appropriation Act appropriated specifically for a certain purpose, then if we overspend a component within this act, then that should be also regarded as irregular. So those were the three big items that were actually of a very technical nature, and we have to go back to Treasury, number one, to get clarity on the circular, and secondly, we'll have to probably get condonement through a national treasury process for this irregular expenditure. I can just say that, yeah?
On the 32 million, I actually personally wrote Treasury to establish, because we had doctors that were on GP contracts that were rendering services. Now, because we under allocated less that amount, I wrote Treasury to establish whether could we use the infrastructure money to pay for these doctors, because they were already rendering services. So if we didn't, it meant that the service was going to be discontinued. And I think this is a choice between, you know, ending that service and stopping the contracts with the doctors, and while still being underspent on infrastructure. So we literally wrote Treasury for permission, and I think it was declined. And this is obviously the risk, and we can share that. On the other one, I think there are two technical matters. The first is the practice notes that the Accountant General normally shares with us. The Accountant General shares practice. In fact, the Accountant General writes HODs and accounting officers to say that this is a practice note, it is effective from this date. This particular practice note, number one, is not signed. Number two, it was issued post the financial year end, meaning it was issued May 2018 to apply retrospectively. And I think it is in these two instances that we've written the Accountant General to establish the policy development process, because if you read the accounting policy guidelines that are followed, that reflect in the annual report, actually they specifically state that the auditing is in accordance to these policies. Now the question is, you know, where a policy is not yet pronounced and it's a document that is not signed and it's only distributed in July and it's not made available in advance, how should it be viewed? And we sought clarity on that. The second one is an accounting principle for which I said I don't have competence. And because we're discussing the infrastructure area, and I just want to paint a scenario, honorable members, because I think it's a balance between compliance and service delivery, which is a matter that we have brought to the attention of both the Auditor General and the Accountant General. We are supposed to issue certificates of completion when a project has been completed. But the basis of the audit, honorable members, is that if you have a room like this and you have to fix this ceiling and you have to fix these chairs and have these are two separate, or maybe the windows, the blinds. The AG is arguing that for each of these projects you must have a certificate of completion. We say you must view a room, and when everything is done, there must be a certificate of completion for a room, so that everything is completed. They are saying when they finish the blind, there must be a certificate of completion. When they finish the ceiling, there must be a certificate of completion. So this is a technical accounting issue. I have formally written to say that the Accountant General must tell us, because for every certificate of completion, we can as well create a department that just issues certificates of completion for every little thing that is fixed. And I just think it's not going to be sustainable, because it's resource incentive, and also resource intensive, but also is going to require people to just sit and focus on that. And we would like to seek clarity on that. And we've got those two letters that we wrote that we will share with you, so that you know technically what are the issues, because they have implications, in our opinion, for service delivery.
I think Chair, at least we feel that we've self-reported a number of these irregular expenditures. The issue that the DG has mentioned is that there seems to be a conflict between the modified cash standards of accounting and the infrastructure development guidelines. In that when you issue a certificate of completion, you also have to issue certificates of transfer to the provinces in this case. which means that you'll have little bits of pieces transferred to each province on one facility. We've actually last year also put together a immovable asset register in line with the recommendation of the AG, which can actually show that the assets by facility and by project. But I must say this issue of the modified cash standard where it talks about the ready for use principle, I think we need to get clarity on that because it's going to give us a very big administrative burden going forward. And also in terms of accounting, we also have the risk then of future qualification. So the letters are available and we can share.
Okay, so on the grants, I'll hand over to the CFO.
Shall I come there? Chair, I'll be very quick on this so we can get to the questions. The total grant spending was at 98.6%. We had some underspending, especially on the REVITE grant. They were spent about 94%. The other grants, like the training grant and the tertiary service grant, HIV grant, was spent close to 100% at 98%, 99%, and 99.6% respectively. We have asked for rollovers in most of these cases, and most of this has been granted. I've got a slide on that. And essentially why it was granted was that we have had commitments on projects going forward. So the overview is just a quick slide to show you that the 98% on all these slides. You will see from this slide that we've had in the financial year passed 314 million rands worth of rollovers, and that was approved together with adjustments of 49 million from national Department of Health. Looking at the grants individually, the training grants was spent at 98.1% spent. An interesting fact is if you look at the second from the right column is the funds that we have transferred to provinces that the provincial treasury has not transferred to our department. Where it shows the bracket, it means that there was actually an over transfer by the provincial treasury, either based on a need or based on the provincial rollovers granted. But in this case, we'll see Northwest, for instance, 9.9 million was not transferred to the Department of Health via the treasury, which obviously gives us a bit of a concern because it means that cash that was supposed to go to provinces did not reach that province for that specific purpose. Going to the third, to the service, tertiary services grant, we had 99.6% spent. Again, Northwest has withheld some funding from the province, and we will have to see how to deal with this in terms of accounting. Just to also say that the Northwest financials are still outstanding. They will still be audited, they're busy with the audit now, so the final audited numbers we're expecting within the next month. So we do expect that this number might change. But as it stood at the time of our audit, then this was the position of funds not being transferred to the province. Most provinces spend within the norm. Where there were delays, it was essentially in terms of the procurement of equipment and also the appointment of specialists. We do find, Chair, that because compensation as a whole is being reviewed by Treasury as a whole, that if we make funds available for specific appointments or specialists and the province is under pressure on some other area of compensation, that we find moratoriums probably placed on HR, which makes it difficult for them to appoint in terms of a specific grant. The HIV and TB grant at 99.6% spent. We're fairly happy with that. Again, the Northwest number we expect will change slightly. The REVITE grant is the one that was the most underspent, if you like, at 94%. You will see that especially in Northern Cape, there was a big rollover produced for them from their own province, which was all transferred, and Northern Cape in particular has been under pressure even in this financial year in terms of the expending. So let me just please stop with this and say that where there was underspent, we found that we had some provinces that had difficulty in attracting technical skills. You will recall that within the grant framework, we made available about 20 million per province for them to acquire certain skills, and most of the provinces have not been able to make use of that. There's some delays in the conclusion of final accounts. As the DG explained, this also affects our provincials. The reason we got was delays from Eskom in terms of connections. But those are all operational ones that I think is easily addressed. There was some revision of business plans very late, so provinces, especially Gauteng at the time, wanted a revision in the fourth and last quarter, actually in the last few months of the financial year, and they couldn't spend the funds in line with the grants. And as the minister referred, this was the one issue where we had to consider making funds or converting funds from a capital nature into goods and services for them to pay accruals. The indirect grants, we spent, you can see the NHI component at 92%, probably what the highest we spent up to now. The HP contracting one was overspent, expenditure was 113%, and this is the area where the AG felt that it should be regarded as an irregular expenditure. But you will then see that the total grant was underspent, and in particular the health information systems. So it's basically, kind of you're sitting between firing lines, because in the one instance you have to declare irregular, and in the other instance on the same grant you find that you have an emphasis of matter in terms of underspent. And I think this is a result of the Appropriation Act that is now being enforced more rigorously by the auditors. The Rivad component at 88%, Ayla Clinic at 88%, and the HPV component was essentially fully spent at 99.8%. And this grant in particular will in the future be a direct grant and not an indirect grant anymore. The DG has, I think, mentioned something on the NHI component in terms of the CCMDD commitments. We had quite a number of commitments at year end. The facility revive component also, mainly because of our implementing agents not able to submit invoices on time, and we have quite a bit of accrual on this one. Idle components, some delay in delivery of equipment, but again very small in terms of monetary value. The HPV component close to 100% spent. The HP contracting was overspent. We've had some budgetary pressures. I think we just mentioned that the service was really rendered, and we had to continue with that service. And we did request a deviation, which wasn't approved at the time. The health information system component, especially on the medicine stock surveillance, was underspent, which led to the emphasis of matter. And I'm sure Dr. Anuman Pillay can elaborate on all the reasons for that, but mainly it came down to a supply chain matters, and also the configuration of the system in particular. In terms of rollovers, which we've requested, this is the breakdown of rollovers. Eastern Cape has requested rollovers on all grants, and by the looks of it, it's all been approved. Gauteng only on the Revite grant, Limpopo mainly on the Revite. Northern Cape on the development grants, as well as tertiary grants. Northwest, we'll still get final numbers, and the Western Cape, and they have some underspent on the Revite grant, which they've requested rollovers. So as it stands, Chair, we probably probably have the 353 million approved for rollovers, and we'll have to just wait for the conclusion of the adjustment process as it stands now. So, yeah, I'll do it quickly, so thanks.
Thank you, Minister and the teachers. Members, there is the presentation. Can we have a question? Honorable Wilson, Honorable Ndaba, Honorable Mapanga, Honorable Chembekwai, Honorable Maisel, Honorable Kopan, that's all. Honorable Mashale, Honorable Wilson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I actually have quite a few questions, but I want to start initially not with your presentation, but those that we received from the FFC and the AG, because those in themselves raised a number of concerns in terms of where both the department and the provinces were going, and I think they're important, particularly when they come from that level. The first concern raised by the FFC was that targets for non-communicable diseases were there. The targets were there, but they were unmeasurable due to lack of reliable information. And I think that is a concern because it's an area of major concern. And if we've set in targets but we cannot measure the outcomes due to lack of reliable information, that is equally concerning in what we're going to do about that. The AG raised a number of concerns in relation to Program 4, and these were general lack of evidence to support reported performance achievements, and amongst those were hospitals achieving 75% with core standards, which is what your report says. However, the AG and the FFC say that there's no supporting evidence to back up your claims. And that is as well as its compliance with infrastructure norms and standards. That is a concern raised there. You have discussed that one of the major concerns was the NHI planning and systems showing an under expenditure of 10%. In light of where you want to go with the NHI, that kind of underspending is seriously detrimental, and it's going to put back the development of the NHI quite substantially. Your slide 746 deals with this, but it was raised by the AG and the FFC as well. The provincial health budgets, particularly in terms of your COEs, 71 for the Eastern Cape, 70 for the Free State, 75% for Limpopo. And that that's quite alarming. Because then obviously nothing else is going to be done when that bulk of your budget is being used on COE. Budgets have been cut. It's no wonder then that we are visiting hospitals in the area where there is no infrastructure, or no maintenance, no water, no medicines, because the funding is just not there to do it. But I think the biggest impact is that we now have severe shortages of specialists and doctors in those provinces. That seriously impacts on the poor in the rural and the vulnerable areas. It's one thing to say that there's a moratorium, but the question is, what are we doing to weigh the shortage of doctors against some of the other situations here? And going back, and as you know, this committee has just been to Cuba, And with our COEs under pressure, what are we doing to weigh the shortage of doctors against the doctors' internship program? And it's been a discussion, and the minister sadly is not here. And what arises from that? Because the FSC report clearly states, the FSC report, that our program with Cuba has been halted. Just prior to leaving Cuba, we were actually told it had been re-signed. So we've got two different sets of information coming in. We've got a shortage of doctors and lots of doctors, and it's been discussed, but I think we must raise it as a concern as a committee, what's happening to them. Because the provinces are unable to absorb these graduates or the nursing professionals because the money is just not there to do it. The budgets are not just there to do it. And those doctors who are prepared to take up places in these hospitals, and it's common knowledge, will not work in those hospitals because of the conditions and lack of infrastructure, equipment, and medicines in those hospitals. We are sitting with billions of rands of medico claims. A lot of this must arise out of lack of equipment, bad infrastructure, shortages of staff where people are now having to work exceptionally long hours. They are tired. At the end of their tether. I think this is a serious concern, and I'm not sure that we are addressing this correctly. And included in that, and from the FFC and the AG's report, is that the payments for capital assets are now out of sync completely with the NHI. The one is saying we must do this, and the other one is saying we can't, and it's not happening. So we have I think we've bottlenecked. I think there is a concern in the increase of the irregular expenditure, and I think what is very concerning is on the AG's report that the National Departments of Health regressed, particularly in terms of the section under SCM compliance. It's something that must be attended to. Chair, I have several more questions. I think everyone wants questions. If we can go a second round, I'll stop there. Thank you, Chair.
We'll have a second round so that the questions that are then being asked in the first round, which then means I'm humbly requesting that we don't go up in the first round, it will be 3-3. Because if we have one round for six questions for all members, I don't think that will be. So if we are in agreement, the first round, three questions, allow the department to respond. The second round, another three questions. Agreed? Honorable Ndaba?
Thanks, Chair. Titi, when you were presenting, there was something that you were presenting regarding reclapping, and you mentioned that the Department of Energy and the Department of Science and Technology are part of it. But, you know, I just want to check with you, what is the role of the Department of Energy on this program with regards to medicine production? And my second question is with regards to that building, its servitors, in terms of the safety of workers. What is the progress with regards to that one? Chair, would you finish with the three? Hey, yeah, it's over in Zima, ne?
No,
okay.
If you want three rounds, it's fine with me, but I think
time.
To allow them to okay. be able, because if you combat them with a number of questions from one, I make an example, I'll say six, how many are we now? So if you can, I think it's much so, it's fine.
Okay. I'll try. I think firstly, Che, I want to... Thirdly, number three, I want to comment on the issue of nursing training. We've been waiting for that report as the portfolio committee, and today at least the minister is telling us that there is progress. But I'm sure if we can get a much detailed report to be presented so that we can be clear, because where I'm seated, I think I'm happy with regards to the new developments, and which will improve the quality of healthcare, nursing care in our hospitals and clinics. And I'm sure as the portfolio committee, we are going to support it. Then I'll move until tomorrow.
Honorable myself, sorry, was your hand up?
Yeah, it was up.
Oh, all right. Honorable Timberwai, then it will be you, Honorable myself. Sorry for that.
Okay, thank you very much. Firstly, thank you very much for the presentation. Number one, I just would like to ask it has been mentioned that the Department of Health 5-year strategic goals are, amongst others, to improve the quality of health care as it is reflected in Program 2, the quality care that deals specifically with the patient safety, incident reporting in the public health care system in South Africa. Understanding that there exists a national guideline to manage complaints. My problem is, I'm just wondering whether the department is aware of an incident that took place in Baragwanath Hospital on the 26th of March, where a poor lady was injected wrongly, and that led to, you know, if it's possible, this is how the patient's lady looked like. The whole section, there's nothing here. You can see the bones. I will share the information with you, DJ. Unfortunately, the minister is not here. I was under the impression that I would be able to share this with him so that he can be aware of the fact. And I don't think he is aware of this. And it happened in Gauteng, and it happened in Baragwanath Hospital. This lady has lost work, and she does not even have any money to go for a medical attention. This is pure, you know, the problem of the doctor. It happened in South Africa. So I just would like to know, I know you don't know about it, but just to report it and to request that further steps be taken about this, because I tried, but the file has disappeared, and no one is having any interest in providing further information about this. So rather than taking this information to the media, let me rather leave it with you so that you can do something about this particular case. That is my number one. Number two, mention was made that you have an involvement with the Department of Science and Technology, but you mentioned something else. Whereas there is also a project called Tswane Khulelwa, and it deals with the, it includes the detection of fetuses at the risk of stillborn, which is very important, and is in relation with health. And then I just would like to know whether you are aware of their involvement in such a project, and if not, can you please also include it in your that thing, because it will help in actual fact the pregnant ladies that are in danger as well. That is number two. And then number three, mention was made that infrastructure is a huge problem. Yes, but the workforce within the hospital is also a major problem, as we have witnessed some strikes and so on due to I can say uncommitted staff that results into dumping and leaving all the patients there to die. Is there any contingency plan to keep such occurrences of unforeseen circumstances like this in future? Thank you. Honorable Mabang.
Thank you, Chair. What is that mean?
Thanks, Chair. My apology for going out during this session. I was disturbed by a very, very serious picture which I've received from my WhatsApp, the picture of my brother's leg. Same applies like the picture which has been shown by Uthembe Kwana. Chair, my question, it's during the oversight visit at in KZN, we discovered through our engagement with the department officials that the department has appointed the service provider for the CCMTD who is not equal to the task, and his performance seeks to compromise the service delivery or the program of the CCMTD. So the question is, has there been any improvement with regard to the performance of that new service provider? Then my second question, it's the irregular expenditure within the provincial Department of Health have increased over the past few years. What is it that the department is planning to do in order to deal with this challenge? The third one is the issue of the accruals. The accruals is the biggest challenge in the health sector. I just want to find out what is being done to deal with these accruals, in particular in the provinces. The last one, Chair, the National Department of Health has been obtaining an unqualified audit opinion for 7 consecutive years. What are the obstacles that prevent the department to obtain a clean audit? I submit, Chair.
Honourable Minister.
Thank you, Chair. My question is that do we still find that funding a fragmented system which has its own challenges is still viable instead of just amending the National Health Act and even the Constitution to have one competency to complement the NHI? In view of the fact that you've just mentioned that there is a gross underperformance in the provinces in as far as revitalization project is concerned. That's number one. Number two is that we declared war on TB, but we still have some areas which are no-go areas for CCOD. How are we going to get to tackle this when we have the no-go areas in the mines that are not yet, mines that are still outside of the scope of the COD, and they are more than what are compliant. So if we want to combat TB, nationally, we can't have no-go area. That's question number two. Question number three is that the program of the students in Cuba is creating a problem because each province has got its own way of dealing with its own students that they sent there. And as a result, there is a confusion. Others get their books, others don't get their books. So if it is under the one administration, in fact, before they even go there, they should be debriefed before. Because they get there, everybody has his own ideas of what it is all about. So if the department can take over, the provinces bring the students and the department take over and fund them or whatever, it's books, give them books at the same time, all of them, not to find that others spend 3 weeks or 3 months without books because the province is still thinking about doing it. So that's question number.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. Chair, I just want to ask, last year, in the annual report of the department regarding the cervical cancer control policy and guidelines, their target, they were saying that they're going to train 18 master trainers on the implementation of the cervical cancer control and policy. And the in terms of achievement, it was zero. So I just wanted to know, what is the status now? Is there any progress? What has happened? The other question, Chair, is regarding the medical students, but this one's there in Russia. The DG remember very well. I was trying to engage with her regarding this. So, but what is important, DG, I just want to find out how far are you with the progress of those students who are studying in Russia, and you indicated to me that some of those institutions, they don't even meet the guidelines that have been stipulated by the Health Professional Council of South Africa, because the province, they are doing their own thing. So which means those poor students that have spent many years there, they will come home not even being the real doctors, but the taxpayers' money would have been used for that. If maybe you can tell us, how far are you? And I've also sent you an email regarding the doctors who have been trained outside South Africa. They've passed the exam board, and they were still waiting to be placed. I think there were more than 20 of them. So how far is the process? Because we're still saying that we don't have doctors, but we do have people who are qualified but not doing anything. The other question, Chair, or what is the concern to me, is regarding the environmental health service people within different municipalities. I'm actually worried that the department, you are relying on municipalities, and we all know that municipalities, those positions sometimes, they are not even, they don't even exist. But you also said that you have done audit to 13 metropolitan municipalities and 20 district municipalities. If maybe you can provide us with the report. Because, as you know, the municipalities, they cannot even provide service delivery to the people. Now, how can they be involved in terms of, doing inspections to other places? I don't think we are fair or we are realistic in terms of what we want to achieve. My last question, Chair, is regarding the NHI. If maybe the department can update us in terms of contracting the GP, the pharmacy assistant, or other health professionals within the NHI pilot project, because we know previously there was a problem in Limpopo, especially where others, they resigned, they couldn't even get their money. And what is the status in terms of the funding of the NHI presently? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Marcellus.
No, thank you, Chair. Let me also welcome the presentation. Let me start with the issue that we have been raising since we came here. There's a perennial problem of performance versus expenditure. You've spent almost 100% of the budget, 99.5%. And the performance is at 64%. There's no correlation between expenditure and performance. Where lies the problem? If you can get an understanding, where lies the problem? You can't present a budget and a plan. You go and spend all the budget, but you don't achieve what you've planned for. What exactly does it mean? I don't understand it. We've been raising this perennial problem. That's financially the same thing. That's annual report. Just continuing like that, there seems to be no system to address this matter. Where lies the problem? If you can just get an understanding. And then the second issue, unfortunately, the minister is gone. Because the issue that is raising on infrastructure, it's a worrying factor. Worrying factor because the implications of that is that the department has been coming to us and present a plan and a budget that doesn't talk to the plan. Because it's you who came and said you want to build, or you want to build and refurbish and maintain 8 hospitals. How do you do that knowing very well that you don't have the money? Because that's what the minister says, there's no money. He's still working with treasure because the money is not available. But the department has been presenting this plan to us with the intention that they want to implement it. And how do you implement something that doesn't have a budget? How do you have the guards of coming before a portfolio committee and present something that you know that you're not going to do it? And come and give the explanation that the minister is giving. But the other most unfortunate part is that in the annual report itself, on the comment, it doesn't say what the minister says. It doesn't. So I don't know which is which then. Because it doesn't say what the minister is saying on the comments for deviations or what. It doesn't say what the minister is explaining. What is the truth? What is the true story then? Because this is an official document that has been tabled and audited and tabled before us and to the public and everybody else. The minister comes here and says something else. Which story that we must take? Because this is a budget review. I remember you, I'm sure you'll remember, DJ, I said that's the process where. And we are still not doing it. That's a process that I said. This is a process where if there are challenges on budget, it's because the budget review is the time when you must tell us that you have implemented the plan, but you have got this constraint in terms of budgetary process. So that when we finalize our report, we are able to say, based on the presentation of the department, these are the constraints that the department is having in relation to the budget. But you are always saying it in passing, some of the things, not even in your slide presentation. You don't deal with the budget review. You only deal with the annual report. You see, and that's where my fundamental problem is. Yeah, well, because we seem not to understand what is this process for. It's a budget review, which means while you are presenting your annual report, you are then able to tell us these are the hindrances that made us not to do certain things because we have got a constraint in terms of the budget, and we are then presenting this to the portfolio committee to say, let's look into the matter. So that when we compile our report, were able then to say these are the challenges in terms of the budget. And Treasurer, as you know, in terms of that act, is compelled to respond when they're tabling their budget in February. But this is a Palestine teacher. On still next. He's presented the annual report raw as it is, and then that's the end of the story. Then the third question, I've got many. Unfortunately, we are restricted to 3. I still have the AG's questions, but I'm not going to go there for now. The functionality, I still go back, did you, of the clinic committees and the WBOT. I still go there. I'm still not convinced. The reason why I'm not convinced is because, well, I happened to, during the two constituency period, to visit health facilities and meet with clinic committees. All of them, without exception, they don't know what is their role. All of them. So how do you say they are functioning when they don't know what is their role? They're still saying they're waiting for a training that they were promised by the department, and the training is not forthcoming. And when you want, when you ask the health facility, they said, no, it's not, it's a provincial department, it's a provincial head office matter. Another office doesn't have budget for that training, so there's nothing happening. So they don't know what is their role. And I understand when they say the province, for example, Mpumalanga doesn't have budget for that. Because I was shocked when I visited those health facilities. Nurses are buying things out of their own pockets. Literally buying. To fix a globe, they must buy. To clean a yard, they must hire people and pay them. Stationery they must buy out of their own pockets just to make the institution run. That's what is practical on the ground happening. That's the situation that is there. And then the clinic committees are just helpless because they don't know what to do. So I'm saying, Chair, there are many things. Unfortunately, we have limited us to three questions. We'll come back with another three and three and three and three.
No, I don't think it will be fair to the department if we are going to ask many questions in the first round. And when they don't respond satisfactorily, we still have a problem. They are going to respond to this round. We're coming back, Honorable Members. They're going to ask your questions. We're going to allow you to ask questions. They are here to answer and for you to be able to be. The only thing that I don't think is provided is dinner. Transport is provided. So if you want to be here beyond 8 o'clock, it's fine for me. You will ask your questions, but in phases, I'm appealing. DG, I hope you will, I'm sure the DM is briefing the minister on questions that have been asked. Can you start responding?
Yes, thank you, Honorable.
Just before, I apologize, Chairperson, I'm not undermining the House. There were urgent issues here in the presidency that are time-bound that needed my attention. That's why I had to rush out to resolve them. I was not just ignoring the House. I know it's very important. That's why I'm being briefed of the question. I need to apologize, but it's an emergency.
Thank you. Honorable members, for the questions, I'm going to leave those questions that were referred to the minister to comment. I will only refer to those that were able to address. Honorable members, like I said, we have prepared some of the documents for your indulgence. The letters that we wrote, Treasury, and the Provincial Health Audit Outcome and the Improvement Strategy Findings and Recommendations, including some of the comments of the FSE. We've tried to deal with those in this, and we'll share that with you. But we've also dealt with the matters of emphasis, and I'll get back to those. With regard to the targets, Honourable Members, when we set targets, I'm going to be circumspect in my response. We it's a negotiation with provinces. We discuss. We have to agree. In fact, there's a document called NIDS, N-I-D-S. That is the responsibility of Dr. Andrews. She will tell you that. By September, we must have agreed on the targets. And in October, I'll still get
a response from one or two provinces who say that they're refusing to stick to those targets. We need to revise them down. So it's a negotiation between the two levels. And Dr. Andrews will let you know. Some of the targets, and I think particularly with regard to NCDs, and the data, what we do, and I'd like to use an example, particularly with regard to the Office of Health Standard Compliance, when they conduct audits, what we do with provinces, we use those as a basis of preparing for the plan so that we address those. So if you want to measure our performance, we can always say respectfully, read the report of the Office of Health Standard Compliance, because we use that as a basis of responding. Otherwise, then it's almost like not very useful. You get inspections, you get reports, and there's no reaction. So our approach was that let's work with the provinces to go back to those reports and see how best we respond so that at least we fix those. But remember, it's a moving target. The AG, when they do, the auditors, when they do their performance assessment, they never go to the facilities that the Office of Health Standard Compliance has inspected. They never select the facilities that we've done work on. So they will choose, you know, the assembly methods is based on their approach. They don't, so we can also influence that. So what we say we've achieved and what the AG does sometimes depends, so there's no alignment, and we might want to discuss that. But because we don't want to force the AG to only go to those facilities where we've done improvements, it's the sampling method, and Dr. Andrews will talk to that. With regard to the NHI, the plan and the understanding, Dr. Pile, Anban Pile will respond to those. The budget and I think Honorable Member Wilson is raising an important point. In fact, we've actually been discussing with Treasury. I mean, what should the threshold be? Because if your COE is 70% to 75%, you don't have money for services. You can't buy medicines, you can't pay for equipment, you can't buy stationery, and it confirms what Honorable Masalela was saying, that you then end up with nurses using money out of their pocket. You know, they buy brooms, and unfortunately it's been an ongoing problem, and it's really sad. So what we've been discussing with Treasury is a model, and this is the, if you recall, when we did the 50 hospital project, we wanted to use that as a model to say, what is a functioning hospital, independent of what the outcome of the Office of Health Standard Compliance say. If you don't have the basic things, just basic, not complicated things to just get the hospital running, if you don't have people, or if you do have people, but you don't have equipment that works, it doesn't help. And I want to cite an example about Limpopo, for instance, for cancer treatment. We had equipment in one hospital, but we didn't have oncologists. And then we had an oncologist in another hospital, but they didn't have equipment. And we were advising the province to mesh the two. And we thought the most logical thing is to move an oncologist to where the equipment is. In fact, they did it the other way around. They moved equipment, and the radiation control officer said, no, but you can't do that. We give you a license per facility and per services rendered. You can't move equipment. You're supposed to move. So these are the kind of advices we give provinces. But I wanted to also use another example. When we went to Free State and we visited, and it's also what we call health facility planning versus infrastructure delivery.
If you want to do infrastructure delivery, you build facilities. You can just build as many as you want. If you do health facility planning, you look at the population set, you look at the population needs, and you look at the resources overall within a district, and you use the district as a unit of planning. Meaning, you don't just look at your public sector facilities, you look at all services in that province, whether they are rendered by NGOs, by private sector, public sector, and you look at what those services are. And then you look at your community that you serve and the burden of disease, and you look at the service delivery output. So there's a particular planning model that you follow. So what we did, for instance, when we went to visit, there were two hospitals. I mean, Tromsberg, you visited, you saw it. The population is 7,000 people. And for that particular day, there were only two patients. Only two patients. And Tromsberg is, in fact, I call it Mujimu Akhoz, you know, because it's put in the middle of nowhere. Okay? Lady Brent, the same. I'm just saying this is when you do infrastructure delivery, because then you don't have doctors who work in that facility. So you have to match resources to the population needs. So in essence, yes, we agree. And I guess this is one particular approach that will follow to change the way we plan for health and the way health is financed. The moratorium, I think the minister has said repeatedly that every time he talked, and maybe he'll talk to it because he had gone out a bit, I'll just raise that. If you talk to provinces, they'll say there's no moratorium. We went and we can give you a list of doctors. I think that the fundamental issue that is of concern is in South Africa we train professionals not to employ them, but there's still a need out there, and we probably need to address this fundamentally. And the Cuban program, the deputy minister has gone out, and I think he'll be able to respond specifically, because the issue about it being stopped, Minister, they say it has been stopped or it has resumed. What is the status? The Minister will also answer. The description that you are caught between a rock and a hard place is true, actually. This is where we are, and perhaps we might want to turn this around. And the Minister has always said perhaps we might want to look at where should the investments be made, and where that can give us the best results. Either we focus on reducing the burden. When we did the Global Lancet Commission, there actually, and I want to respond to the example you gave us, and both honourable members, of people who have been harmed in our facilities. There are actually 8 million deaths annually, 8 million deaths annually, globally, annually, quality-related deaths. And this is a report that has just been released. So the question is, I mean, unless we recognize this quality concern and we confront it and we respond, these problems will persist, because we live people worse than they were before they came into our facilities, and it cannot be. And these were our findings in the Lancet Commission report. With regard to Mendaba, Honorable Mendaba, Kitlapila, the role of Department of Energy, so Kitlapila will respond. Safety, Civitas, we actually have a report, we'll share the report with the with honorable members. The department that is competent to determine whether the building is safe to be occupied or not is the Department of Labor. We wrote Labor. They issued us with a report. But we also called and invited the National Institute of Occupational Health to assess every single aspect in terms of occupational health and safety. We'll share those reports with you. But we've been in court, honourable members. We'll hear the outcome of the court case. We'll share the report with you. In fact, just now we received a letter from one of the labor organizations asking that we should sit around the table and help them, because they've also realized that it's something that we've gone out of our way. But of course the problem persists with regard to the speed at which public works respond and the quality of work and so on. But we've prepared a report to you about progress, and we've prepared it, what public works has done, what is outstanding, and where we are, and so on. Nursing training, honorable member, will it be okay if we invite the chief nursing officer to come and present? I think it's better if she comes and she presents everything, because our anxiety at the time was not just about development of training materials. Our worry was the level of readiness of our institution. Remember, all of them must become part of higher education, and there's a cut-off date. And we're just worried that if they are not ready, most colleges will close, and it means most nurses won't be trained. So she'll also present that, what the minister said earlier, but also our level of readiness. I think she'll be best suited to present to you, if you allow us. Honorable Maisela, funding, I asked the minister to deal with NHI and the amendment to the National Health Act and the Constitution, war on TB, but again, both minister and DM, it will be, I'm not delegating. It's just that it was about funding a fragmented system. It's not viable. So you must amend the National Health Act and the Constitution and have one system of funding that's viable. And then war on TB, that we still have no go areas for CCOD. There are certain areas that are covered by CCOD and others are not, particularly with respect to mines. And problem with Cuban students and lack of uniformity across the country, that national must take over and control of the program to achieve uniformity. Honorable Metemba Kwayo, yes, indeed, the quality of care, like I said, I can share the Lancet report. You'll see the analysis that it is true, it's a concern, but we'd like to have this information about this particular patient so that we can see how best we assist them. The science and technology project in Tshwane, we'd also like to have that so that we can see, and I'll refer Dr. Andrew to follow up on this particular one, and Dr. Pile about the fetus, you are aware, you'll respond. He seems to know about it, he'll respond also. The picture of a brother's leg, which also, if you are comfortable, can you also get that information so that you follow up? And oversight visit in KZN, and CCMD Dr. Pile, Anban Pile will respond, and about this new service provider, whether is appointed, and the concerns about performance of the previous one. Irregular expenditure in provinces. We actually prepared a document for you here about some of the annual financial statements and interventions, and you'll also respond about the SAICA project and how we can help provinces, not only irregular expenditure but accrual, and what is it that we are doing to assist. The CFO will respond. Now, the 7-year unqualified audit, what are the obstacles? If I've said it and I'll repeat it, if tomorrow I do away with grants, we'll get a clean audit. But the question is it desirable? And this is probably one thing we have to confront. If our job is just to develop policies, regulations, and we bring legislation to Parliament and we stop and that's it, is that enough? Because the grants are also a way of engaging and intervening in provinces. And perhaps we might want to look at a different approach. One proposal from Treasury that we might
want to change the way we work and how we engage. Now, we have 10 by 10, which is co-chaired by us and Treasury. And we discuss the regular expenditures, accruals, we come up with plans, but at provincial level, we still need to understand how provincial treasuries provide support, and it's a missing link.
So, sorry, Gigi, sorry to cut you. Because both the minister and the DM has also tendered an apology. They are leaving more or less the same time. I think it will be appropriate that I accord them the opportunity that they respond to questions that were directly directed to them.
I'm leaving at 6. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. I don't know how far we still are, but let me try to answer a few questions which I could pick up. The first one, Chairperson, I don't know, the DG is giving you the technicalities, the court cases, but there's something happening in South Africa. We seem to be a country where everything that is bad happening in government, we like it to be repeated. And we live that, and we urge for it to be repeated. I'm not very sure whether it's a new mentality that is starting to be in our country. We had a terrible, terrible situation routing about life is demand. When there was a problem at Tower Hospital, life is demand too, and it was built up. People were even opening accounts, saying money is coming in because at life is demand, people were paid and all that. And one of the TV stations was repeated every Tuesday about how bad the situation is there, human rights, people died. When the Umbas came with the report and found that it was not like that, it brought anger. I'm sure you are aware what I'm talking about. Tower Hospital. That there is no life is demand here. He called it copycatting. You are copycatting. Nothing like that happened in Tower End. He even brought a very scientific report, but he was being attacked. Then the Bank of Lisbon banned. The next moment, problems were dealing with labor in our department. The next moment, it's all over TV. Another Bank of Lisbon. It was all over, and people were looking at it, phoning us day and night. We're working in these buildings. It does have problems, yes, which have been flicked, which we are resolving. But Bank of Lisbon, you know, they even tried to ban it twice, putting fire on a building like that with 1,500 to prove that it's like the Bank of Lisbon. And what happened? On both occasions, the five features of fire system in that building dealt with that assault. The first one was they put fire in the area where we put all the garbage before it's taken away, you know? And then because there is a sprinkler system on the ceiling of that building, there are smoke detectors, there is a hose system, there is a fire siren, and there are this hydrant, you know, it just got five features. One of the features just went on and extinguished the fire, but they never stopped there. The second one, they went to an extent of going to the ceiling to cover the smoke detectors with plastic, so that when the fire is put on, the smoke cannot be detected, to prove that there is a Bank of Lisbon. But fortunately, the siren went off and the building was extinguished. The third one, and when the engineer came to tell, look, I'm not blaming anybody, I'm just telling you what happened for you to understand. The third one, when the engineer came to tell us, was even trembling with fear. That building, because of the manner in which it's running on four chillers, which pump all air and all that from the bottom up there. And those chillers are so big, they are not connected to ordinary cables. If you know electricity, they are connected to three-phase cables. You know, these huge cables. And when they get repaired, they go and cut the cables. They get cut off. Now, why the engineer was trembling? Because they cut off the earthing. And he said, if the wire cut with no earth, that whole building was down.
and we're just lucky that it didn't go down. Then we're taken to court. Nobody could present to the court of law any shred of evidence about all these things you saw on TV. That's why the judge dismissed it last week. I'm sure you are aware. The report that the DG is saying is going to give you was dismissed last week. We are being told that people are sick every day when they got there. You ask for a simple medical certificate. Any one of you here who doesn't come to work because he's sick, you're going to ask for a medical certificate. It can't just be a person saying, no, I'm sick. But, you know, so we don't actually understand. That's why we even want to leave that building just for peace. Because, you know, this everyday toy-toying, people being moved out, we going to court, it's not good for delivery in the department. But I just want to inform you about that building. And the judge dismissed that last week. There's no judge in the world who will subject so many people to certain death if information is given to that judge that people are likely to die. The moratorium, Chairperson, I'm sure you have heard this story. You called provinces here many times. They told you there's no moratorium. In 2017, when Minister Bravin was still the Minister of Health, I even asked him in the budget speech to read and say there will be no moratorium on coal-faced delivery of health, meaning doctors, nurses, teachers. We can have moratorium on management, but not on coal-faced delivery. If you check the 2017 budget review, those words are written there in black and white. But when you go to provinces, people are not being hired. And you ask the MECs, even in MINMEC, one by one, no moratorium in my province, no moratorium, no moratorium, and you record it. Then you get surprised, doctors get angry, nurses, all over TV, they said, no, the minister is lying. We tell him there's a moratorium, because I even appeared on TV saying there's no moratorium, because I know the Minister of Finance agreed with us and even read it. Then guess what we discovered? 8 of the provinces, except the Western Cape, have been put under Treasury administration, either Section 100 as we did in Limpopo Northwest or Treasury administration. When a province is put under their Treasury administration, the first function that they take away from that department is human resources. They take it away and say you are under administration, you're no longer dealing with human resources, the Treasury is. And how does that happen? No, you can advertise any post you want, but you can't hire until Treasury approves. So it's not a moratorium. We just want to approve. We have not stopped you from hiring. We just stopped you from giving the person the letter of appointment until Treasury approves. What happens is that approval never comes, Chairperson. It never. People get interviewed, even specialists with rare skills, interviewed, win the interview, wait for 6 months, no approval is coming. But when you ask, they all say moratorium. Even in the health summit, which was held on the 24th of October, civil society asked the president, please let this moratorium be removed. Because the experience is a moratorium. Even in the last PCC, Presidential Coordinating Committee, where now all the premiers come, for the first time in the history of the country, they brought in MECs, health, education, and local government, because that's where there are problems. And this issue arose, that this moratorium, whether you practice it by putting the department under administration, it must come to an end. So there are already 3 or 4 which we're dealing with this. But yet our provinces will tell you no moratorium. So whether you call it a moratorium or not, the effects were the same, that people are not being hired. And that's why, if you check, it's going to be one of the president's stimulus packages. Now, the issue about CCOD and Kwaeda no-go areas. Chairperson, let me explain it just in short. The country has got 2 mechanisms to compensate people for occupational diseases, and it's very problematic. Firstly, under the Department of Labor, there's Kwaeda, Compensation of Injuries and Diseases Act. This one compensates people who have got an injury or disease in any factory except a lung and heart disease. That's where the complication is. any injury you get or any sickness or whatever type you get, whether you work in a mine or in a whatever factory, including mines, if it's an injury or a disease, you get compensated by a coita from Department of Labor, except if that disease is in the lung or the heart. That's why it confuses people. Then you come to the Department of Health, the CCOD, Compensation Commissioner for Occupational Diseases, the one you deal with all the time. It compensates you for lung and heart disease only if they occur in a mine or works. Works meaning the quarries and the smelters and all that. And because of that, the compensations are not the same. They differ. For instance, Quaeda compensates people much better. And so when you are a worker, you must pray, or my disease must be Quaeda compensable. If it is CCOD, you are going to get very little money. So we've been discussing with all the unions, and on this one, they are united, that we need, and the people who are leading this is the Deputy Minister here, and the Deputy Minister of Minerals, Oliphant, Deputy Minister, particularly Olomisa. They've been meeting with Labour. We are now ready to put to Parliament one act and say the compensation mechanism must be the same. It can't be many acts. And that process is on. All the unions have united on it. Now, the issue of doctors who are qualified, pass exam, and not deployed, Honorable Kopan, I don't know how many times we've been dealing with the unions about this issue. Even in a summer conference in July, I have to field this question. And I want to explain, Chairperson, what's happening here, because not all doctors are the same. Firstly, you have got intern, and I'm sure you know what an intern is. An intern is statutory. There can't be a debate whether that person must be hired or not. It's a statutory function, and I've repeated that many times. Once you complete medicine, you've got to do internship. Otherwise, your life has come to an end. You can't even leave the country. You can't go to practice. You've got to work. And we've told that provinces. The problem, Chairperson, is again the structural governance issues of the country. The structure that accredits hospital for internship is the Health Professions Council of South Africa, HPCSA. They go from hospital to hospital, look at certain criteria and say, here, you can train 2 interns, there 10, there 5, and all that. And they finish the job and they say for the province. And naturally, they usually accredit Gauteng, KZN, and Western Cape more than any other. Reasons are simple. Internship is still training. Now, once they finish accrediting, the provinces must then create the job itself. And that's where trouble starts. Because they just tell you we've got no money, Minister. We know we've been accredited for 100 posts, but we can only fund 70, the other 30. Then it becomes all people point fingers at us, we take it to MinMed, and they just tell you we have got no money in this area. But now we are trying to deal with it from January, and we are still fighting, even for next year. The second group of doctors are community service, which is also statutory. The third are registrars, who are people who want to do a senior degree. We also have a problem with it. We're trying to solve it. Once the university, even if the university agrees to train you, if the province does not create a registrar's job, you can't be trained. And that's another problem we're having. It's not statutory, but we need specialists. But if provinces don't create those jobs, they just tell you they've got no money. The fourth group of doctors are what are generally called medical officers. This is a doctor who has finished internship, has finished community service, but is not doing a senior degree, just wants to work as a doctor, no matter how many years. They are called medical, like me. If I go back to work, I will become a medical officer, unless I want to specialize, but I qualify for a medical officer because I've finished everything. Now, those ones must look for a job like any other qualified person. Now, what happens when you talk to provinces? You'll find that they've got many vacancies for medical officers. But the interns, they tell you, we've got no money. We've filled certain posts, we've got no money. Then when you said no, can you convert the medical officer post? Because they are there, they are not filled in. I mean, if you go, even now, if you go to Eastern Cape, you'll find vacancies of medical officers. There's no way that you won't find them. Every year it's like that. I remember last year they gave me 70, and I distributed it all over the doctors who are said to be unemployed. They found that those jobs are in O.R. Tambo and Alfred Nzo, those who know Eastern Cape. And doctors said, no, I'm not going there. I'd rather look elsewhere. So they filled only 30 of those medical officer posts. The others remain vacant until the end of the year, even though people are saying we're unemployed. Now, when you tell provinces, because these medical officers' posts are not filled in, especially in rural provinces, please convert them to internship. And they give you an answer, which you can't challenge them on. They give you a clear answer and say, look, an intern has to work under supervision. He's still in training. This post here in Chilizini Hospital, I want the qualified doctor. Nobody's going to supervise this doctor. He must come ready and become his own supervisor. So I can't bring interns here on this vacancy when they still need training. Now, those are some of the conundrums we are having. And then lastly, when the unions fight, especially some, about unemployed doctors, it usually get it on the media, like the most recent one I got. They say 100. When you ask for a list, you find that 80% of them are foreign nationals. I don't have anything against foreign nationals because this matter is sensitive about xenophobia and all that. But we have to go back to a drawing board. The number of foreign nationals who are rushing to South Africa to look for jobs, especially in health, with the public saying, yes, we know you are short of doctors, you must take them. It's not happening with any other degree. You have got a shortage of engineers in this country. You have got a shortage of architects. But it's in medicine where we are being forced that because there's a shortage, you must take anybody who comes. We even went to some judges to advise us because we've been threatened with court case. We now have a police, which some are still threatening to take to court. Because I said, Chairperson, what justification do I give to South Africans who are unemployed, whether they've done medicine or not, to hear that we've created 100 posts for people who don't come from South Africa? And I'm a South African, I've got a degree, I've got no job. So we debated. We called Pharma, we debated in MINMEC, National Health Council, and came up with a policy that for any job will give preference to South Africans. When we finish, then we'll go to, you remind me, where I'm forgetting. When we finish South Africans, then you go to number two is, what do they call them? No. No, permanent residents who are not citizens. There are people who have got permanent residency. And in terms of South African law, after spending 5 years here, you are a permanent resident. I personally fought when we were driving that policy, that if a person has been in South Africa for more than 5 years, that's a citizen. Why don't you employ them? I mean, then I get an answer that there are people who stay not 5 years, 20 years, but refuse citizenship of South Africa and still want to keep a citizenship of another country. But when they want a job, they suddenly must become South African. But when they are told that, no, you have been here for 20 years, please apply for citizenship, you qualify for it, they said no. They remain a permanent resident, which means they are a citizen for another country. But when a job avails itself, we must rush in and give those jobs. I found it very difficult, Chairperson. So we have got that prioritization list, and yes, because I mean I'm going to be very open. If I'm accused for xenophobia and all that, in 2016 when some of these problems started, there were 56 nationals from DRC who passed here and they all wanted internship. It was very difficult for me, and when I checked, there were 18 from Nigeria, and when I checked, there were 9 from Zimbabwe. All of us saying, "Give me jobs, give us jobs." These are not just. This is not just training, it's a job. You must give a salary for that. I'm sure you understand what I mean. So that's when we started doing this preference. I went to Minister Blading Demand, who was the Minister of Higher Education. I asked him about these figures. Why? Because I know the fight for medical scheme school positions in the country is intense. Even now, people are going to write matric there will be fighting left and right for a position in a medical school. And I said, how then do we get people from other countries, so many, to get into a medical school when South Africans are fighting for this position? That's not xenophobia. It's just practical. Then I was told that there is a SADC policy that says all the universities in SADC, 5% must be expatriates from another country. 5% of the total student population. It's not only in health, it's the whole university population. But the minister said, but that policy is one way. It only works in South Africa, not in the neighboring countries. Because the people who are coming to South Africa. Nobody lives here to fill that 5% space, unfortunately. I then asked a question. If this is the policy, minister, how do I explain the 18 Nigerian nationals who are now angry, threatening to take us to court? They want internship position because Nigeria is not SADC. I'm sure you know. And he was shocked. He also didn't know. I said, but this is not a SADC country. How do we end up here? So that's when then we went to the drawing board, draw this issue about preference. And they'll always be there. These people I'm talking about, 56 from 2016, are still there. And time and again, they appear on TV, they go to political parties, they mobilize students and say this is unfair. And this is a big problem for us to solve, Chairperson. I just want you to know that. Now,
group of South Africans who have studied abroad, from Turkey, Russia, I think that excludes Cuban students.
Yeah.
Yes, China.
Yes. Mm. Without telling us. Chairperson, without talking to us, and when they come back, they've got problems with the Health Professions Council. You are aware that Honorable Singh from IFP raised it. It was even debated there, you know, about this issue. And it's because provinces send them there without even talking to us. They don't. So we have taken this issue with the presidency and DECO, because DECO is not very happy about it. We are not saying people must not train in other countries, but there must be an agreement. The students here from Cuba did not just go, Chairperson. Yes, there was a sitting down agreement between two countries. We even sent our academics here, including the Health Professions Council, to go to Cuba to look at the curriculum and see if it will suit us here. And every year that trip still happens. Dr. Papa has just undertaken it this year. Take all the deans of medical school, academics, Health Professions Council, to go to Cuba is an annual thing. So that if there are problems, you know, you solve them. But if you just wake up, you find 100 students who went to China, and you don't know where to place them. And guess what? We discover that in China, they are not doing any practical. They say, we are giving you theory, you'll go back to your country to practice. And he just arrives and says, yes, I'm here, I passed medicine in China, but I've got no practical. I mean, we've never planned for it. How do we do that? So when Honorable Singh raised it, we said we'll do it a once-off and discovered that there are only 300 of such people, especially from KZN. That's why it was raised for him, who just went to China, you know. One parent even sent two people. When they come here, we don't say you are from China, don't come in. No. We say follow the rules. What are the rules? Go and write an entrance exam. Because what they've been trained on is so different, they failed the entrance exam. And the law says you write three times, if you fail, you can't come in. Those two students from the same family wrote three times, they failed, and the father demanded that I must change the laws. They must write for the fourth time. And go to TV and say there's a shortage of doctors, my children, and all that. Then he even mentioned something that scared me to my bones. My children are so determined to do medicine that they are now volunteering in a hospital without a salary. I got scared to my bone. You can't volunteer in medicine. I phoned the MEC. Do you know that you have got two volunteer doctors in this hospital? No, I don't know. Go and check. He checked, he found them. Please remove them. You can't have a volunteer doctor. It's very dangerous. Then the father phoned me how evil I am. I don't even want people to volunteer. It's practical, Chairperson. You are talking here of medical, legal, and all that. Can you imagine if you are touched by a doctor who is not registered, and they damage you, and we tell you this is not a registered doctor, but we allowed him to touch you inside the hospital? What are you going to say about us? So we need to solve that problem. Fortunately, in the last PCC, Presidential Coordinating Committee, this matter was given to DECO, that provinces are not federal parts of government. We are one unitary state. We need to go with one law. And DECO will come and bring that law here and say, please stop. This Mpumalanga issue of Russia, can you imagine people? I was not even aware. When you phoned the MEC of Health, how did you send people to Russia? No, it's not even me. It's the Department of Basic Education. How? Basic Education is responsible for training of doctors. Yes. Now we must solve it. We must go and find out in Russia what institution was there. We never knew. The MEC also did not know. It was done by Basic Education. So we believe this federalism that's happening around the country is really causing us problems. And DECO must solve it and stop it. And the numbers which go to Cuba, even the Cubans are complaining, Jefferson. You know, the rate at which we go to Cuba on fact-finding mission, we meet on the way. Yes, there's a province which I just had, Deputy Minister just told me yesterday, they are sending 7 people to Cuba on a fact-finding mission. You know, when you tell them, no, we have agreed with our premier, we must go and all that. Then, you know, so we said DECO must stop it because when we do it, they tell us, no, my premier agreed with me. He's the one who chose this team. The last issues that I want to deal with, the malpractice, the DG was dealing with them. The Cuban program, are we terminating it? I'm sure the deputy minister might have something to add. Chairperson, contrary to what you may believe here, the Cuban program is in demand, even in developing countries, because it's based on primary health care. Primary health care is in demand because curative health care systems are becoming too expensive. Yeah. And Cuba has managed primary health care. When the UK phoned us 3 years ago that they want to come and evaluate the Cuban program, we refused out of paranoia. We said, no, they are going to evaluate it and say it's rubbish. We refused. Then they realized that we are resisting. They went to KwaZulu-Natal, got 3 Cuban graduates, sent them to UK to interview them. They went there with the MEC for health in KZN. He accompanied them, and I met them last week, who have qualified long ago, and they said, no, they were interviewing us about this program, its values, and all that. The problem with the Cuban program is when they come back home, we force them to do our curative system, not primary health care, which they've trained with. Now, these 700, yes, we want to give them that primary health care. In fact, in what is this district in KZN next to Newcastle? Dundee. Dundee is in what district? What do they call it? Umzinyati or Umnyako? Yes. But that district which headquarters is Dundee. KZN once did an experiment, removed all the Cuban doctors from hospitals into communities, and maternal mortality dropped. Because you know these pregnant women personally. You get into a house, you know what is she all about. You know the person. It's based on knowing people directly and dealing with their social problems which are linked to medicine. And so that's why we won't stop it. So what are we stopping? In South Africa, these two programs is true, Chairperson. The one that started in 1998, we're sending 60 people only. 10 per province, 5, etc. per province. And then we increased to 8. Then 5 years ago, we started a new one. This one is sponsored by Cuba. They don't pay anything in terms of tuition. Then we started a new one, which it was paid for by us. And we sent 1,000 students. And we kept on sending, especially KZN. One set of them came there. And then we discovered that provinces are just sending these people. They are not budgeting. Then we started a war of paying Cuba. Hey, province pay. We write letters. Even to premiers, they are not paying. And we realized that this program is becoming too big. We can't stop it, but let's pause a bit. Can we clear 3 groups before we start another group? The first one where we're sending 10, we never stopped it. The original one, which was funded, and Fidel Castro said, I don't want to send. We never stopped it. And the second one, we didn't stop it. We said, let's do it cyclically. Even our universities, when they come back, they can't absorb those numbers. You understood the whole about the 700. Dr. Parker had to run to all universities and all that. Then we said, let's clear it. Once it's clear, you start another group. But stop it, we can't, Chairperson. It's a program of the future of the world. primary health care. The fact that Cuba, using that program, became the first country in the whole world to stop mother-to-child transmission of HIV, you would have known about it if it didn't happen in Cuba. If it happened in America or Europe, you would have read about it every day. They would have mobbed it in your ears every day. There would have been a Nobel Prize internationally for that, because it's the biggest achievement of humanity to stop mother-to-child transmission of HIV. But because it was Cuba, you don't know about it. What stopped it is the primary health care we are looking for. And so I want us to respect that. Accrual, Chairperson, I'm going to repeat. Much as we accept this massive corruption in the healthcare system, much as we accept this mismanagement and irregular expenditure and doing things and lack of skill, much as we accept that, but we also want the country to accept one important thing. If for 3 years you reduce the budget of health by 9 billion rand, but in the private sector you pump in 11 billion in the same period, what do you expect will be the outcome of the country? Because that's what's happening. For us who use private hospitals, I'm saying us because all of us have got medical aid, subsidies of 11 billion are pumped into us. From the public sector, we take 9 billion away. What are you expecting? Shortage of staff, this infrastructure I talk about, these are real. And it took a long time even for the cabinet to understand where to battle. And fortunately, in the last PCC, one of the resolutions is that health budget must be recalibrated. We must re-look at them from the scratch, because what we have done over the past 3 years is injustice. And that's why they are going to recalibrate them. And I hope when they recalibrate them, that money that has been taken away will be brought back. That's exactly what we are hoping for. Thank you.
GM?
Yeah, no, thanks, Chair. Just briefly, Honorable Maricela asked whether on the Cuban program, why is it not run nationally? That's a desire from our side. Also the desire of the students, the point he was raising, that the students themselves are unhappy about unequal support. But as you would know, that this is a human resource development program. It's part of human resource. And human resource development and deployment is a provincial competence in terms of your equitable share. That's where it belongs. So you can't, until such time that the configuration of funding, there is provision where you can deploy nationally and create service posts nationally, it will not work. So it's tied down to our funding formula. As long as the funding formula remains like that, I know that at national, there's a few programs where we have provided bursaries, but it has to be very limited because we don't have capacity to, after completion, deploy those professionals. Very limited, therefore. So on a massive scale, you can't run it nationally unless the funding formula changes, where you can actually deploy, create posts and deploy service providers. I mean, the area of actual health services. If as long as it remains like it is now, that's why, because on the other hand, international relations is a national responsibility. The management of the program is national, but the actual support and selection is provincial, because at the end, that's where the function rests in terms of our system.
We are looking at the possibility, just a possibility, of taking this program, give it over to higher education, because higher education is a national competence. And say the training of doctors better be done through higher education as part of university education. Then you have solved this problem of HR being provincial. We are looking into that. There's another question here, Chairperson, I forgot it. Why are we staying on unqualified report for ages? Did they say 7 years? Mm. Yes, the DG gave an answer, but I've got my own version. It might be wrong, but I need to share it with you.
because I asked for it. There are 9 provinces and 1 department, national. If you check throughout a period of 5 years, it was 3 entities, national and 2 provinces, Western Cape and Northwest, who were getting unqualified audits. And then from there, Northwest bombed out in 2014, unfortunately, which when the mediocres of this world started invading them, they bombed out. Now, if you check from 2010, the province who has been getting consistently unqualified audit is Western Cape, even before national. So if there's any clean audit, I'll argue, if I use that logic, it might be wrong logic, Western Cape should have attained that long ago. So when they didn't, I went to Professor Greg Hausom. When he retired, he was the longest serving public servant, not in health, in the whole country, and asked him, why have you been getting this unqualified audit for so many years? It's your 19th year now in the public service as the HOD. He said there is nothing called unclean audit which will ever get in health. That was his view. He said you will never get it. No, there's nothing called clean audit. And I said, why? He said, if they were auditing us simply on money, we'll get a clean audit someday. But the manner in which the auditor general audits in health, for instance, if you say I've got 4 million people on ARVs, I'm sure somebody will correct, they want to give a proof that those 4 million people are there and they are getting their ARVs every month. If some of them bumped out, you are audited negatively. If you say I'm immunizing so many kids for polio, so many of what, they actually want the actual, they say they want evidence. So it's a very difficult thing because, as you know, some of the HIV patients get lost from us. Some of the kids we immunize, we don't even know the denominator. It's a reality. At some stage around Tabazimbi, they've immunized more than, I think it was 110% of the kids. I mean, how do you immunize 110% of the kids? When you went to check, is because you can't discriminate when you immunize. You know the population there from South Africa. There are people from other countries who are there in large numbers. You start immunizing them, it says 110. And the auditor general wants to come, want the proof for you. And you know these people move around. They can't tell you, I'm from Zimbabwe and I'm here and all that. So it's a difficult task. And he told me, as long as the auditing is like that, we'll keep on getting unqualified because we are not necessarily stealing the money. I mean, in those provinces that are getting unqualified. But when it comes to the overall audit to be clean, and I'm not saying we are not striving for that, but at least that's the answer I got. And maybe it may be corrected one day, I don't know. But I got that answer.
Before you leave, Minister, I just want to, two issues that have come up. One is this issue of the students in Cuba. Our view, as much as you are looking into all these other things, we had a view, we are going to produce a report and there will be recommendations that these students, they must undergo a 3-month orientation of what is Cuba, what should they expect, and so that is two. I don't know how provinces are going to manage to do that. Psychologists, because we have picked up a number of some of them who were drunk in the meeting, and we pick up that it's not because when as parents we started to be agitated, but at times we understood that it may be out of stress and the psychological. So as we will be producing that report, those are the things. Personally, as a health activist, I still feel that the program must be centralized. We will then see what to do with that. The last thing which I want, and I'm a bit worried, Minister, because you are also raising this thing. Health sector, it's not only about doctors. Long queues are a result, among other things, of a shortage in the administration. A clerk that is to produce a card for that patient to be seen by that registrar, by that specialist. Clinics are dirty because there's a shortage of general assistance. Escorts are taking their own relatives with them in the wheelchair to X-ray department. So we have to balance this as much as they are specialized, but you can't have a health system which is clinical and they go together, it's clinical and the administrative. So that's why I'm saying I've been waiting for you patiently to hear you talking about the administration, the importance of having drugs, because that's what KZN told us when they were here. That in fact they are told by their treasurer that So it is that balance. As the department, we have to look into that. And because as the committee, we really feel that it is these small things that, if they are not taken serious by the department, we are not DG. A registrar is not going to feed the patient. A registrar is not going to cook for the patient. A registrar is not going to clean laundry. But yes, a registrar is important. For that registrar to produce good work, the environment must be an environment that is going to enable. That is why abanye festival nabo bathi hamba, we can't work in under conditions that are filthy, and therefore the balance. So that's my humble plea to you as the leadership of the health sector, that please look into that so that we are then able to. I thought I must raise that before you leave. We'll produce the report. We still have to check with the parliamentary group that left before us, led by the speaker, because we went to Santa Clara. We don't know. They met the students in Havana. So we still have to check. There are scary issues that are happening there. We will tell you at an appropriate time. But the issue of them being inducted and the psychological that is affecting them, we think is very important. Provinces, at the end, before you leave, at the end, Minister, whatever, people out there are not interested in provinces. The buck stops with you as the national department. And therefore, it is in this program, I say, Chubayon. We will have to. We are really going. Before we leave, to finish a letter, we think that this is it. We have to look into that. Please address Lendoye provinces that are sending abantwana all over. And I agree with you. It's very scary. When we were told that kukhaba hambayo, I have been told by a number of people, umntana mbe train in China. Then I said, go to the department. I don't know what to do about that. So I'm saying, those are the challenges that we will have to deal with, both as health activists, as leadership, as public representatives. At the end, we will have to ensure that we look into those. I thought those are the issues that I must raise before you leave, Honourable Minister.
No, thanks, Chairperson. We are already deconverted on these issues. We can't oppose you on any of them. You're 100% correct. On the issue of cleaners, the whole spectrum in healthcare. When I said, Minister Bravin said no moratorium on cold phase delivery, nurses, doctors, etc. That is the only thing I could negotiate. I was negotiating that there be no moratorium in healthcare. What Treasury do, they will give you figures of compensation of employees and say it's already hot. One of the highest, which was discussed in the PCC, is Limpopo. Their compensation for employees, was it 73? Yes, 73%. And they said, what do you want us to do? And they show you. But when you check, there's a shortage of doctors, of porters, and all that. You know, so we could only negotiate up to a level of doctors and convince the Minister of Treasury, because it's about money. And I'm
again going back, Chairperson, I'm unable to send this message back. Even this weekend, no, from Friday, there will be a summit, the health summit. I know nobody's going to hear this message. If you cut 9 billion rand from a healthcare system that is already so overburdened, you know, cut it over the 3-year period, why do you expect that there should be no consequences in infrastructure? And that money was cut mostly on HR and human resources. That's where we lost most of the money. So what then do you decide? You then set at least, if there's a doctor or a nurse in this hospital, you prioritize, and I know we might not agree. That's when the porters start falling off, the laundry staff start falling off, etc. We are in this trouble. That's why the concession we have won, and I'm waiting to see how it will work. Just this morning, I was discussing with the DG of Treasury. When we went to the cabinet committee, I said, DG, I really hope and pray that this time around, this resolution will be implemented. He said, which one? Recalibrate the health budget in the country. They are not what they are. And as long as they are not like that, we'll keep on choosing. That's where we are, Chairperson. If you have got anywhere to help us, that help is welcome. Hey, I'll really celebrate and say, at long last, Parliament has been able to help us on this problem. You know, in KZN, I even went to the Premier's office. As the Deputy Minister told you, he said it's an equitable share. It's a provincial function. I went to the Premier's office to tell him exactly what you are telling, because nurses were getting angry when they have to become porters and wheel people to. I said, Premier, please. I then sent Ms. Timing. Yes. She spent a long time there helping them to develop a basic minimum staff that is wanted, especially around the Durban area. You remember after the oncology saga? Well, yes. And when she developed that, it was not only doctors. She developed porters, nurses, what, you know, London, everything, and gave them a package. After a long time of hard work, she was needing that. And it was saying they need about 300 million. And they said, Minister, we don't have this amount of money. Forget. And I said, can we at least cut it by half and start hiring half of those? Then the NEC came to complain. I don't remember in what meeting, about the fact that the relatives have to wheel their own people. I said, but Chief, if you complain and the money is in your province and I've been there, how do we solve this problem? Because you are the one who's complaining and the equitable share has gone to your province. This is hiring people, is not a grant or what. It's equitable. And so I'm just praying and hoping that the recalibration will help. The Cuban one, I don't want to underplay the problems. We've already sent psychologists there at some stage. We've already sent a team, and we believe, yes, maybe it must be permanent, because many kids believe when they go to Cuba, they are going to some United, New York, and all that. And so when they arrive there, they found a different thing. They, you know, so I agree. The orientation program was once done, and I was part of it in KZN. I don't know why they stopped it. I was invited where they were orientating. I remember telling them that you are not going to hell, but you are not going to heaven either. Please understand, it's still here on earth. Now, many of them and there's something that's happening, Chairperson, I can't hide it. In the original program, we said we are sending people from rural areas in families who they are extremely poor. Some of these kids who cause problems for you come from well-to-do families. They are not used to hardships. And you start wondering whether there were no favors done. Where a child of somebody who is well-to-do end up in Cuba and demand the type of life they've been living at home because the parent is very rich, whereas it was done for very, very poor people who will be grateful. But lastly, Chairperson, and please understand me, there was a strike in Cuba at some stage. When was it? 3 years back. And there was a big hullabaloo in the country that we must stop it. Kids are getting drunk, they strike. Chairperson, some of the things that happen in Cuba are happening here at home every day. I'm being honest with you. There are universities where they won't on strike because it's recorded. They want 6 packs of beer from the university for freshers' ball. If they don't, then they go on strike. But if it's done by 10 or 2 to them from Cuba, it becomes an issue. They do it here at home. They even done buildings. Like, you know, the amount of buildings that were done in Cuba, when they complained, they never burned anything. So I'm just saying some of the things the students do there, even here at home. Somebody was complaining to me that they found them having started some charismatic churches there. It's true. And the Cubans are not used to that. Yes, but aren't there charismatic churches here in South Africa? Yes, where people fill stadiums and all that and eat snakes and grass and all that. But when students who are South Africans continue with that thing in Cuba, we seem to believe it shouldn't happen. So I'm just saying we must also check what is happening at home socially, whether it's any different, but I agree with you. Perhaps we should send permanent psychologists, psychiatrists there, because what I also understand is because psychology and psychiatry is also culturally inclined, that when they get this problem, they send the Cuban psychiatrist, might not be able to help because this person is suffering from some cultural shock or ailment, and the Cubans are not, yeah, they don't understand, if you understand what I mean. Eh? Yes, if you say my ancestor says this, the Cuban will get confused. Yes, so yes, that's a very good example. So we thought maybe South Africans, social workers, psychologists who are South African, who understand our culture. Yes, because psychiatry is like that. There is a big religion and social aspect of it, and a Cuban psychiatrist won't deal with that. And maybe that's why you will have noticed. But if you come home, you'll find them some of these things in our own universities, including impregnating each other. There are those who started families there. But get to our universities, you'll find the same thing. Thank you.
Is it to the minister? It's what? If it's not a question.
He didn't answer my question about we are not a unitary state. All right? I mean, we are not a federal state. We are a unitary state. So, and health is an essential service like education. Why do we make it fragmented where everybody does his own thing? Unless we think about that one clearly and do something about it, we're not going anywhere. Thanks.
Chairperson, we are, and I was accused by this very committee for hiding when I told you. On paper, we are a unitary state. But in practice, four things are not unitary. One of them, the DMS mentioned, human resources. What do you budget for human resources in a province? Who hires who? Who knows what? Who becomes a CEO? Who gets fired? They are all provincial functions. In fact, people appeal to me. Even doctors, when they get fired, they say, minister, I've been fired and failed. Go to look at the national, I mean, the Public Service Act and the Labor Relations Act. All of them is about the MEC, the CCMA, the Labor Court. The minister legally doesn't come anywhere. And these are the things that we need to change. Then look at financial management. The equitable share is the biggest part of financial management. It gets determined by the National Treasury and the Provincial Treasury and the Provincial Executive Council. Then comes the issue of procurement. Where is procurement done? And the last one, maintenance of equipment and infrastructure. So those things, and people complain even to the president that no, it's concurrency. Those four things are not concurrent. They are pure provincial functions. There's no concurrency about them. And all of them are the ones that cause problems in the country. So we need to change them, and that's why if you need to look into the NHI document, we are saying 12 acts have to be reviewed and be corrected. Professor Makhoba mentioned it in Life's Domain and say when I went through my investigation, I found laws that are so purely provincial that should not be and will keep on causing these problems. So I agree with you. But the issue of unitary is on paper, on these four things, it does not exist. It's purely provincial.
No, thank you, Minister. Can we just have a comfort break and then allow the comfort break just for 5 minutes, then the beat will come back, we'll have another round. Comfort break,